Okay, this is Makuhuna Maui, seminar number 27. Today is October 13th, 2011, and we're starting 7 p.m. New York time. If Ion joins us, there'll be a copyright factor here, so this will be copyrighted under New Grandview Incorporated, all rights reserved. Okay, so I'll put this back up on. Okay, we have as a guest today Scott Taylor from Toronto, very close student of Marshall McLuhan in the 70s. And then we have another Canadian, Chad Nante, who's in Vancouver, who attended the University of Windsor in the 90s. And the first day of class in the English department, the professor wrote out the name Marshall McLuhan. So Chad's been interested in McLuhan for 16 years and has also interacted with Ion. So that is always good. So I'm going to continue, Scott, in the vein of looking at Croker. So I'm going to get my Croker book, Hacking the Future. And you go to the back, and he has an explanation of his McLuhan world. What? See, Croker had to, Arthur Croker out in the University of Victoria, what's it called, Chad? Out there in Vancouver Island.
Yeah, it's University of Victoria.
On Vancouver Island. The way he writes is obviously influenced by McLuhan. He has to make a reason why we don't just talk about McLuhan, we repeat McLuhan stuff. There's a new level that requires Croker to discuss media without following McLuhan's line. So here's what he writes on page 132 of Hacking the Future. Under a section at the end of the book, he says, Doors of Misperception. Hacking the Future is the cultural politics of the 1990s, and this book came out in 1996. So this book is being written right when everybody, thanks to Netscape and the popularization of Tim Berners-Lee HTTP stuff, people get on the internet easily. So right at the beginning in 1995, when it went on a big mass level, Croker says this, Hacking the Future is the cultural politics of the 1990s. It's about decoding the present and recoding the future, breaking into the ruling algorithms of contemporary politics and society and creating new cultural algorithms for the virtual future. So then he says, everybody, and he titles this section, subsection, Two Blasts, T-W-O. So is he referring to Wyndham Lewis's blast and McLuhan's counterblast of 1954? Redone in 1969. So he says, everybody who lives in the late 20th century is a potential hacker of the future. And why not? Everything has already been blown to, in brackets, digital bits by the power of virtuality. Life at the end of the second millennium is about living in the aftermath of a violent implosion of culture, politics, and society. In the short space of a single century, human experience has suffered a double technological blow. First, it has been fast processed by the invisible media of electronic technology. What McLuhan could only prophetically talk about in the 50s and 60s is already an electronic reality that is in our past. Just when we understand the grim implications of McLuhan's warning that the invisible media of electronic communication have outed the central nervous system, that is, when McLuhan really does make common, in brackets, electronic sense, technology does a quick flip, and we suddenly find ourselves living at the end of technology, in brackets, in the form of an external media escape, and at the primal beginning of the age of virtual reality. And this is the blast that hurts, because now it's no longer the central nervous system that is being externalized or ablated, but technology gets a life, detaches itself from the human species, and begins to grow a new telematic body just in time for the 21st century. Two blasts, then. One electronic, and that's italicized, that has ejected the nervous system from the privacy of the body, and the other virtual, and that's italicized, in brackets, that is rubbed together the externalized central nervous system with the soft language of algorithmic codes and began to grow a new, quote, distributive species, unquote, which he then has a colon and adds distributive intelligence, distributive sex, distributive feelings, and distributive sight, close, have a bracket. Then he says, after this double implosion, life as we know it is like one of those immense stellar meltdowns where we're in a spacecraft riding at the edge of the known universe, experiencing all the while the shock waves and spatial perturbations of this violent decompression of society and seeing all around us the zooming debris of the human wreckage. And he says, ends this section by saying, ironically, the privileged media of electronic technology provide us with perfect viewing screens on the virtualization of human flesh. TV is a great portal on cultural implosion, colon, a just-to-the-minute visual simulator of how our in brackets, our bodies are virtualized by gigantic image-based processors, freely resampled, and then played back to us for humiliated applause. Music is a favorite listening port for our disappearance into cyber ears. Cinema has now been reconfigured into special effects to give us the actual feel of human flesh as it is coded into blurs of sight and sound and image matrices, and then speed-forwarded into digital life. Think of Forrest Gump, which I think came out in 94, Braveheart, Apollo 13, and Waterworld, so he names four movies, monuments to the disappearance of cinema into special effects. Then he says, the media of the electronic age are the future museums of the body virtual. Now, I know he has, so I go to the very end of this larger section called Doors of Misperception, and he again talks about McLuhan. Hacking the future continues McLuhan's concept of artists as probes, with this key difference. For McLuhan, artists were early radar systems for detecting major transformations in technology, probes that went ahead of the general population, much like the earlier tradition of the artistic avant-garde. Hacking the future is about going faster, deeper, and with greater intensity into the interface between being digital and being human. Privileging human wetware in quotes, rather than hardware or software, hacking the future is about creating cuts, disturbances, and transgressions like a space or an interzone between digital reality and human subjectivity. Certainly not a theory of, quote, understanding media, unquote. So he's not presenting himself as a text for understanding media. Hacking the future begins with the assumption that traditional media have been superseded by hypertext flesh, seven-second brains, and wetware minds. Human beings always go faster than technology because people have always been hypertext, colon, fully linked, netted, downloaded, parallel processed, and interfaced. Virtual flesh is always ahead of technology, and that's the terrain explored by Hacking the Future. Thinking ourselves as wetware to the hardware of technology and the software of the coding labs finally opens our minds to the doors of misperception. Then he has a final section in the book called Hacking the Future, and he has four exits: exiting Nietzsche, exiting Marx, exiting McLuhan. So I'll read the exiting McLuhan part. In the 60s, McLuhan theorized that the technological media of communication were, in his term, quote, extensions of man, electronic outerings of the central nervous system. But that was then, and this is now. Because in the 90s, it's exactly the opposite. Not technologies and extension of the human sensorium, but the human species is a hot-wired extension of digital reality. No longer the will to technology, but the vanishing of technology into the will to virtuality. So McLuhan is dealing with the phase of will to technology. Croker's dealing with the later phase, the will to virtuality. Hacking human flesh by way of artificial intelligence, virtual reality processors, and the violent force field of electronic media is a sure and certain way by which virtuality actually eats the human body, becoming digital flesh at the end of the century. And then there is something called exiting the 20th century. Beyond Nietzsche, beyond Marx and McLuhan, hacking the future is pulp theory. That's pulp for the end of the millennium when all the bodies are piled up 1 mile high. Not virtual or heavenly bodies, but bodies that are trying to cope with life lived in the twilight hours of the 20th century. So there's a little more, but I'm not going to go any further. Now, Scott, who's in Toronto, you have written about virtual reality in some of your essays. You kind of agree with Croker. right? That the McLuhan's metaphor doesn't work once we're into the 90s or something. Is that accurate?
I'd like to be more explicit there. I actually do agree with McLuhan when you look at the laws of the media, and he talks about reversal. So McLuhan was perfectly aware that that would be the rhythm which the medium would adopt, or in general digital media would adopt.
So Coker is really in the reversal phase, but doesn't want
right.
to acknowledge the law of media tetrad.
That's right. And McLuhan always, Croker uses continual analogies, and McLuhan was perfectly aware that although any particular analogy is false, that the set of all analogies is something closer to the truth. And what happens is that Croker uses analogies as if they are more literal, and then becomes lost in his own poetical dialogue or dissertations.
Yeah, now he says in his book, McLuhan, Innocent Grant, 1984,
right.
Maybe it's Innocent McLuhan Grant, Technology and the Killing Mind, he says in his essay on McLuhan that McLuhan fully went over into the simulacrum, and that was his genius, that he was allowed himself to go into it. Is that going fully into the metaphorical trampoline you were saying? That
McLuhan, this idea of the simulacrum is already an adulteration of McLuhan's sensibility there. McLuhan was exploring the nature of the word, or
right.
a word, and of language phenomenology, and what happened to it. And he was fully aware that in some ways culture used, or any particular language, was using a simulacrum as soon as it adopted a language. So a language, to a certain degree, is a necessary evil. And so in that case, you had to, he then resorted back to looking at the compilation of biblical texts and the Gnostic history of its development.
So you're saying that Marshall understood words as simulacrum already?
Yes, to a certain degree, because when we use a word, we are outering certain social aspects and particular aspects, certain continuities and interfaces, which do reveal part of the process that's going on, or the mutual accord of realities.
Okay, now you talk about it being post-word, which I was taking as like Croker. How would you distinguish what you see as the issue today in the virtualization of society that's different from Croker and different from McLuhan?
In a way, I'm both a footnote to McLuhan and somebody who is in dialogue or conversation with Croker, although my knowledge of Croker and involvement with Croker goes back to the 90s. And I haven't read anything he's written recently, although, of course, I'm interested in his C theory and often read articles there. McLuhan was unable, I think, to continue his exploration of what I've just been talking about, and in terms of autism or selfism or the inability to use language in conventional terms. And so I thought, not so much as a disciple of McLuhan, but more as a collaborator, that I would just pick up the ball a bit there and move into what I called a theory of social autism. And it was based basically on the idea that the more that we imitate our machines, the more that we become autist-like. And what that meant, an autist uses other people as if they are media, as if they're objects. There's a kind of complete divestment of any subjectivity in terms of the autistic lifestyle. I know that that's a naive assumption about actual psychophysiological autos, but I still took that as a kind of place to begin to understand what was happening. And so I tried to monitor the decline of and the transformation or transmogrification of language, particularly as it was used in media context.
Media context, you mean how it's used in movies and television and CNN? That's
how
it's
used in computers, how people like the Churchlands would, their assumptions about language phenomenology, and then how that developed in terms of cognitive engineering and also in terms of, you know, this so-called development into semantic kinds of computations, which, by the way, I think are extraordinarily distortive and are a complete illusion and delusion because they're not contextual and they're not contextualized to a particular living body.
Yeah, you're talking about the Churchlands' work, the couple.
Yes. Yes.
What is that school named? Is there a name for their approach? Materialist?
Well, cognitive behaviorism is, they're just computer experts related to that. And they're very brilliant people, and they're worth looking at because they will take you on in a very firm firm discussion. But if you look, too, at some of the major philosophers of the age, and I'm not as familiar with Chamberlain, and so I was I had worked with Douglas Hofstadter.
Yeah.
And so I tried to see how they were communicating their ideas with one another. And Hofstadter, who I saw as a kind of social autist, I took a course from him at the Banff Center in the early 80s, and I kind of saw him as an extremely literal kind of thinker who was trying to understand how analogy worked because he recognized that he was ill-equipped to really deal with analogy. And he makes a huge flip from the time that I first knew him until when we start looking at his more recent publications, where he leaps into the idea that the essence of the human being's thought processes are completely dependent upon analogies.
So you think he became more interested in the McLuhan tradition or what McLuhan contributed? And that might be a factor.
He distanced himself from McLuhan and would have been one of those people that poo-pooed McLuhan and quite strenuously.
In the early phase. In the early phase.
In the early days.
Yes.
And partially just for political reasons.
Yeah.
Who are you referring to on this point? Are we still talking about Churchland or?
No, Hofstadter.
Douglas
Hofstadter.
You know that book, Gödel, what's the famous one?
Gödel, Escher, Bach, The Eternal Golden Braid.
Yes.
And I really recommend it. That was apparently the last book that McLuhan was reading before he died.
Yes, that I was there at the last seminar, and the last public, you know, Monday night thing in December 1979, and I remember there was a young guy there, and he told me all about that book after that evening, and I think I had seen it on the table. He was very excited about it. And so, yes, McLuhan was looking at it at the very
McLuhan end. McLuhan felt that if he could discover the essence of the human cognition and soul trying to decipher the analogical, that would be a way through to, for want of another word, the truth.
Right. Now, Croker, do you see him putting on the postmodernist, almost like McLuhan, going in, be an expert on their language, the Baudrillards, the Deleuze and Guattaris, the Lyotards, the Barthes, the Foucaults, and then bring in actually a Canadian twist, a Canadian McLuhan twist.
You're right on. That's right. But he was an essential kind of Canadian intellectual thinker when he first started working, you know, I thought that he was fantastic when he brought out the postmodern scene, ecumenical culture and hyperaesthetics. He and David Cook, it was really couched in a lot of arcane kinds of nonsenses, but it was getting at some things that were really introducing Canadian thinkers to postmodernity, the so-called philosophical ethos of it.
Yeah, I would say the McLuhan, the actual replay McLuhan, was his emphasis on Augustine. That's a total McLuhan expertise or angle.
Yeah. And Aquinas.
Yes, and to bring them into and say that there's a replay of those guys, or that those guys were postmodern. That's what he said. Augustine was a postmodern, just as he dealt with the desert of the end of the Roman Empire. We now had in Croker. Croker said that in a postmodern scene, I think, that Augustine was a postmodern thinker, fully aware of the collapse of a lot of things, because it was the end of the Roman Empire, 400 A.D., just like we have to deal with that, and McLuhan dealt with it. And then you have Marshall himself, when he first meets Tom Wolfe after Wolfe does that article, or during the period when Wolfe was working on the famous What If He's Right, McLuhan is telling him, and this is the more esoteric part of McLuhan, that the patriarchal fathers and Augustine were totally relevant to understanding the symbolists and modern 20th century art. He was saying that to Tom Wolfe in 65.
Yeah, but what he's really talking about is exegesis. He's talking about the grammarians and the church fathers and their ways of understanding sacred text. And so since it's in four parts, he saw that, as we've discussed before, as the four parts of an analogical argument.
Right. Now, you also pointed out that the techniques of the anthropologists would be quite familiar to Augustine. And so if you think of Croker as an media anthropologist invading the European postmodern scene as an anthropologist, there's even that part of Augustine that McLuhan celebrated, that McLuhan meant that was his McLuhan's technique too. I mean, that's the discipline of anthropology, studying cultures as art forms. So Marshall enters in with those, with that ground, and then creates media as art forms. You know, so he comes in as an anthropologist with Carpenter, but he moves it to another level. So he's being he's using the anthropological technique by entering modern cultures and saying there's another aspect to notice called media.
Yeah.
And Croker redoes that. Now, I don't know if Croker knows that Marshall. He definitely knows that Marshall used Aquinas, but I don't know if Croker knows about the Augustine point. But he uses it. He does that. So that was really, I don't know if you call that Canadian, but that's really McLuhan-esque to make that point.
Well, McLuhan was also looking at Augustine as one of the people who began the construction of the individual I.
Yes,
Yeah, so
now
these sessions are a wonderful mine load of information on how the self was being constructed in the context of the revival of a lot of biblical texts.
Right. That is the important part of Croker's essay. He says that the classical world could not resolve the antinomies in existence and being in that, the endless contradictions. Now, McLuhan would say, well, the classical world wasn't a problem for the classical world until the phonetic alphabet showed up. Then Augustine shows up well into the phonetic alphabet phase, and he resolves the antinomies and contradictions of primitive experience, or whatever you call that, semi-literate experience, by creating a third term, or the individual I and the individual psychology. Now, Croker says that. When I read that in the late 80s, I said, that's visual space. Why doesn't he acknowledge that McLuhan was explaining what Augustine did? And that's where I began to think, well, you're redoing McLuhan even to the point of the private visual space, which creates the, quote, soul or the self. You just said it, that that's what Augustine did. Croker notices it, but Croker does not want to point out that McLuhan saw that.
When I was reading Croker and a lot of other people, I put on a little bit McLuhan's glasses.
Yeah.
To see, you know, what, and, you know, McLuhan wouldn't I'm not saying this to disqualify Croker, because some of the rest of us have needed him, but McLuhan would have completely disqualified it. He wouldn't have bothered with Croker.
Right. That's, okay, just take that thought. So do the other McLuhanites of the Logan, Tom Cooper, de Kirchhoff generation. When de Kirchhoff had a McLuhan conference about 1998, when the Croker spoke, mainly Arthur, but Mary Louise was there, at some point in the conference, they started heckling him. And I see when I read Croker now, like the Data Trash Booker or Spasm, they're way more valuable prophetic statements than anything those guys came up in the last 15, 20 years. So I really think there's an importance to understanding Croker, because Croker restates what McLuhan knew, but in a new...
I really agree with you, but in the next context, the context of what does postmodern thought mean for the Canadian people.
Right, because one of the last works of McLuhan was he's reviewing, there's an essay called Figure and Ground in Criticism, and he reviews all the schools of literary criticism that had developed since the late 60s, and he just categorizes them as right hemisphere and left hemisphere. And it's a skimpy article, and I know that it would never, that would not be enough as you get into the Baroque spiral of the 80s, where people have lots of time and computers to write incredibly complex essays under the influence of Derrida and Baudrillard and Barthes. McLuhan's simple categorizing wouldn't work. And I'm wondering, what do you think he would change his language? How would he have approached the 80s? And let me just say this. It's even predicted in the Laws of Media, he does a tetrad on scholarship. It's somewhere in there, and he says it'll turn into medieval counting the number of angels on the head of a pin kind of stuff. McLuhan predicts, or both McLuhans, predict the hyper-trivial complexity.
Well, he would have thought that it was a Baroque recorso.
Yes,
I think, and so he would have wanted to jump ahead to the next peak, when in to use Zion's terms and sometimes McLuhan's, the real point that there isn't a point, and that that's where the process takes off again. That's where the clock begins ticking.
Yeah, he ends his Playboy interview saying, perhaps when the book closes, then the true story begins. And you see that Derrida and Barthes, they keep the book industry going for universities in the 80s and 90s. They give course administrators something to complexify and confuse the students and all that. McLuhan himself in the late 70s was starting to work with David Greenberg, who lives here in Maui. Nobody knows this, and was going to move to L.A. and do a Jacob Bronowski, Ascent of Man kind of documentary. He was going to leave books behind if he had the opportunity. Are you familiar with that ambition?
No, but I know that he laughed about Bronowski.
Yes.
He thought of Bronowski as being one of those people who work with the 10 greatest, those kinds of things,
yeah.
You know, 10
yeah.
greatest thoughts, the 10
yeah.
greatest whatever. And he always thought that that was Reader's Digest mentality.
That's right. He was going to redo what those things, there was Ken Clark's Civilization series in the 70s, there was Bronowski, and there was Carl Sagan's Cosmos. McLuhan intended probably to just, you know, do the greatest series and more complex and use media. The point I'm making is that he may have moved out of books, because I'm thinking, how could he apply his simple categorization to even to Croker's book? Croker writes really good stuff in Postmodern Scene. you can't just say come in and go, well, that's left hemisphere adaption of kinetic space or something. Do you know what I mean?
I'd like to clear up something about that, too. You know, like right away people think, oh, McLuhan was falling into the popular cliched ideas about this this division between the left and the right hemisphere. No.
Right.
This is where people have a problem with the hot and cool media. He recognized fully that it was much, much more complex than that. But he thought that if you talked in that way, you could move into a kind of news rhymery, which would allow people to begin to engage with his thought. And it also, a lot of the discoveries in the 70s did make McLuhan's thought merit more attention. But
what's that phrase, news rhymeries? What did you just say?
Oh, I'm thinking, news rhymery. You know, like I'm thinking nursery rhymery.
Oh, okay. Yeah, news rhymery. Good.
Yeah.
I would just say this, is that he would take the new fad, which was the categorization of left and right hemisphere, and point out that that wasn't the issue, that we had two brains, but that the media, a deeper ground, hoiked up one in favor over another. That's a different level.
He'd start looking at it that way, but even then, go further than that.
Okay, so he would.
Let me point out one thing about Croker. Croker is really good at pointing out sometimes things that deserve a lot of attention. And in just looking over the postmodern scene, at one point he talks about what's going on is the demythologization of the mythology of time, or the mythologies of time.
Right.
Well, yes, wouldn't it be interesting if he had really written a book about just simply that, a good, focused, left brain book that went through it and take up where Wyndham Lewis left off with his time in Western Man.
Yeah. Now, the thing is, Croker wouldn't, because being in the post-book world, he joins a punk band, I think with Steve Gibson, and he tries to make short videos. He actually is doing what McLuhan would have done if McLuhan did what David Greenberg said they were going to do, is that Kroger's not going to spend too much time on books, even though he does a major book with Michael Weinstein, The Data Trash. But then that could have been 50% written by Weinstein. I just became aware of who he was or where he was, and he's got many books since Data Trash, Culture, Flesh, and that. He seems to be an accomplished writer. It's interesting how Croker... he always collaborates, usually, as McLuhan did. You know, he collaborates. He gets the other people to do the writing, or part of the writing. I mean, Ted Carpenter says he wrote a lot of Understanding Media. So you have Croker, St. Mary Louise helped him write some of the stuff. He has David Cook helping. He has David Weinstein. I'm just saying this is where his abilities lie, rather than doing a left hemisphere text that you just were looking for on time. What do you think of that? Do you think that he could do it?
I don't know. I'm never quite sure where he begins and when he leaves off. Whereas when I read something where McLuhan collaborated, I have a much better sense, a canny sense, I think, I hope, about it, where what he's doing in there. The thing that the people did when they collaborated was more organizational. And McLuhan didn't need to connect the dots of his own thought because he had the whole gestalt of them. But what a collaborator was more of an editor who would arrange the material in ways that would be more easily comprehended by the reader. Whenever he had somebody who tried actually to contribute and actually to write with him, as in the case with Wilfred Watson, it was a war of words and ideas. And I think that we should be grateful to both McLuhan and Wilfred Watson for having tried to do what they did. In other words, shuffle their decks together.
In the book From Cliched Archetype.
Yes, in the book From Cliched Archetype.
Yeah, and you can see that he drops quote, drops Wilford and adopts Barry Nevitt, who was more congenial to doing the editing for the book Take Today. So that Barry becomes his main collaborator, at least in the public level, in the 70s. And Wilford, where does Wilford end up? Out there in Edmonton doing his own theater? What did Wilford do in the 70s?
Well, in the 70s, he was finishing up teaching at the University of Alberta, and he taught a course in Shakespeare. And he was actually quite a magnificent professor of Shakespeare. And then he and Sheila, after living for a few years on Windsor Drive, moved out to Vancouver Island at Nanaimo. And he
ran a kind of symposium there, I heard. People would visit.
Well, I'm not sure it was a symposium, but we have people like Shirley Newman going out and working with them. There was a real scramble there to get all of Wilford's material catalog printed up, published, and all that sort of thing. And we really need to be grateful to Shirley Newman for pushing all that forward.
Okay, so you were in touch with Wilford in the 70s into the 80s. What was his main enthusiasm or gripe about McLuhan as he watched McLuhan continue in the media escape in the 70s? Were you privy to what he actually thought of what happened to McLuhan?
Well, he was indignant that McLuhan didn't allow him the respect to see the points that he was making. I think sometimes he made very, very valid points. But they were antithetical thinkers in a lot of ways. And I see myself as a kind of a synthesis between these two paterfamilias.
Right. And William Irwin Thompson writes in the 80s that Bucky Fuller and McLuhan were autistic thinkers. Ah, A-U, autistic.
Yeah.
And
no,
it's interesting.
Maybe. McLuhan never.
Never, but Thompson was trying to do something with McLuhan, saw that he didn't work with him, and it might have been an immature assessment of McLuhan's reaction to him to Thompson in the early 70s. But I think he then goes on and brings in the Buddhist and the astral and the spiritual parts of media dynamics. So I see you as a combination of a McLuhan, Watson, and Thompson.
Yeah, I haven't done as much Thompson, but on reading him, I really appreciate his humanitarian, his humanness. You know, his essential lived in the body kind of.
And you don't get that from McLuhan in reading McLuhan?
Well, let me put it this way. I think of myself as an original thinker, which may be a great pretension.
And I should just say, we've interviewed you before in Mom, and you did discover things in James and Stein and someone else that was new for McLuhan, right? Let's put that in mind.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
You might
and I was one
quickly
that introduced McLuhan to some of the new theories in left and right brain, neurological theories.
So you're original. How are you original then, what we were about to say?
Oh, good grief. Well, just in terms of being able to plot a little bit forward in terms of social autism, seeing how, you see, now today, it would be no point in really putting that kind of material forward because social media is the social autistic form and format. And if you're involved in it, you have no understanding of what it would be like to be an autonomous thinker as we see all the way through the 19th century.
Right, and you've stated that you find it hard to come up with a language to critique social media. Did you say that to me a few months ago?
Yeah, you bet. It's really, really hard. I'd like to do that. I'd like to use my originality to do something like that. People are no longer prepared to entertain that kind of critique outside of an academic forum, and I'm not too pleased with the academies.
Right, it's obsolete in both fields to write books or address that issue. But now here's what's interesting. If you take Croker, he deals with social autism, but he doesn't write about it like you do. He talks about the genes leaving
the
physical
body. All the way through his stuff. Yeah.
Yes.
All the way through his stuff, he's got perfect little nuggets of quotations in his own language that can be used. But he does not seem to be aware that he himself has already passed over into that territory.
Yeah, I've attended several times in the 90s when he would speak at a conference. He would talk way longer than what the other professors would do. He'd go like 45 minutes with this, quote, almost tirade, reading his complex stuff as if he didn't care about the reaction. And maybe he was miming the takeover of genes, leaving the body and emerging with the data sphere, and then being Leviathan and just hogging the communication. I sometimes thought it was a performance part. But maybe Douglas Copeland's accusation of McClune being autistic could be applied to Croker's public self, the way he presented himself. Does this sound
that's one of the common themes I've noticed when I listen to Croker in those sort of techno-poetic rants that he goes on. He likes to use the words recombinant data.
Yeah.
And he really interleaves the biological with the technological, with the digital. And I just wanted to go back to, what was it, from Hacking the Future, where the two blasts were outlined with the electronic and the virtual.
Yes.
That brought to mind the Notes on Burroughs by McLuhan, where I've always felt that Notes on Burroughs is McLuhan sort of rubbing up against Croker territory.
Yeah.
Because in Notes on Burroughs, McLuhan uses the Naked Lunch and Nova Express to illustrate this, biological theater.
Yes, that's the term he uses. I think he's quoting Burroughs because he puts it in quotes in that review.
Right, he's using Burroughs' term, biological theater, and he says that man provides the sexual organs of the technological world.
Yeah.
He's taking the position that he's expressing Burroughs' position. And I found it interesting that McLuhan chose to look through that lens.
Well, he was putting on Burroughs.
He's putting on Burroughs, but I always found that that kind of, the Notes on Burroughs was standing
out. No, that's really important what you're saying, because the whole thing of Deleuze and Guattari's body without organs, and then Croker flips it into organs without bodies, and most of his spasm and data trash is about these lasered eyes and wacky tongues and different parts of the body having a life of their own. That's a biological theater metaphor, that with science and genetic knowledge replaying what McLuhan says about Burroughs. The interesting about, are you aware of that review, Scott?
No, I'm not.
I'll send it to you. It's really interesting because Burroughs critiques, he says Burroughs is the closest to Finnegan's Wake, and then he says that both Joyce and Burroughs were in panic mode and wanted to turn the media off. McLuhan does not take that view. He separates himself from that view, which shows another level of acting by McLuhan, because he critiques Burroughs as reacting. Marshall wasn't reacting. He was acting as an anthropologist or a mediologist, engaging whoever he was interacting with the put-on level. And we see Croker is doing that, but the panic level that McLuhan, he would panic among the dumb people or the slower people. But when someone who comes in, like a very perceptive person like Burroughs, and he's panicking, then Marshall takes the contrarian pose. And he is critiquing someone panicking. That's a very interesting thing. And that might be a Lewisian technique, because he's lumping Joyce in with Finnegan's Wake in that essay. Anyways, I see that Croker is adopting the critique of panic mode that McLuhan sees in Burroughs and Joyce. So Croker is even redoing McLuhan there, just based on that one essay.
Right. I always saw it as a segue between, getting from McLuhan, if one is pursuing a bridge to Croker.
Yes.
To get from McLuhan to Croker, and especially with respect to that theme that Croker always seems to weave through everything, which is recombinant data and coding of human genetics.
Which is McLuhan's replay in the Tetrad.
Right. But this particular essay, Notes on Burroughs, with the biological theater that he highlights, really provides the stage for that.
Yeah, you're right.
I always had this idea that Croker might have been inspired by the notes on Burroughs.
Yeah, we don't know. I said replay. But Croker, with his recombinant theme, is doing the retrieval aspect of the tetret. Now, when Croker spoke at Bruce Powell's conference at York in 1997, as soon as he was speaking one day, and then apparently he was supposed to do something the next day. So I jumped out right at the end. He had laid out this whole thing about how Baudrillard went further than McLuhan, and there were four levels. And I said, I jumped up and said, do you see what you're laying out is like McLuhan's tetrad? And he puts up his hand and says, no, Bob, no. Well, we're going to do that tomorrow. He didn't want to explore that. And it was like I'd expose tomorrow's topic. Well, he didn't really do it in the next day's topic. And he always claimed he was going to write an essay on McLuhan. And I don't think he's ever done it. And back then I was talking to him, and he said he was going to put what I was bringing up in this essay. He never did it. Now, when he says McLuhan in Data Trash is the culmination of the emergent philosopher tradition, do you remember that part of Data Trash, Scott, where he talks about Salma Alexander and Teilhard de Chardin? They're emergentist philosophers predicting something coming, and he's correct by saying that McLuhan saw that it already arrived as a technical fact. But then he says McLuhan was hoping, as a doctor, that we could modify the media diet. And then he says McLuhan failed to see that technology came back on us and started eating us alive. That would be the naked lunch. But McLuhan says back in the hot and cool Gerald Stern interview right then that media are cannibalistic. So I take issue with the distinction Croker tries to make. Would you agree with me?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that's a false distinction.
Yes. And I can see Croker doing it as a representative of the Canadian mind, because David Cook, I've talked to him, he said, David Cook told me that he turned Croker on to what was going on in Europe in the 70s. And after Croker caught up on it, was reading it, he said, we got to do something. We've got to enter this arena with a Canadian slant. And I think that's what they did. It's not stated, but it's a retrieval of McLuhan, pretending, for those postmodernists who didn't want to acknowledge McLuhan, pretending that he was different from McLuhan. But we, McLuhanites, or insiders about McLuhan, know that's not true, that Croker replayed McLuhan, and that distinction is necessary. So you're aware of that, Scott. What I'm saying now, you see that that's what's...
McLuhan had already leapt over the postmodernists. He was pretty dismissive of them. I mean, the only ones that he was really aware of at all, well, the one, for the most part, that he was aware of was, of course, Foucault, if you embarked.
And Derrida, in Gordon's biography.
I wasn't able to
talk to McLuhan about that.
I don't know what he thought. Really.
Well, in Gordon's biography, he says that Derrida is a Manippean satire of academics.
Right, perfect.
Right, but that's what McLuhan already was, and it's almost, McLuhan was not limited to doing Manippean satire in the book. Derrida is just a conceptualist Manippean satire, or Manipulan satirist, whereas McLuhan is trying to deal with the global theater and the multimedia world and how to be a Manippean in relation to that.
Yeah, I'm not sure that Derrida would recognize himself as a Manippean satirist
at all. That's true. So, but the point is that McLuhan was sitting poised to keep up with where Baudrillard was going to go and maybe do it more comprehensively, but he did not have the platform for it. Definitely couldn't use universities anymore. His language had run its course, and so his inkling to get into a TV series was, I guess, what he was hoping to do. He says as early as 1970 in a film magazine interview that he's got maybe three, four, five, six books left. They were in the burner and ready to go, and then he was moving beyond that. So he did state in 1970 that he was moving out of the book world, and he didn't get the opportunity until he met David Greenberg in the late 70s through Mary McLuhan. So that's an interesting story where he was going. This was when, remember, Trudeau was getting kicked out, Joe Clark's taking over, McLuhan's having trouble getting his grants. It's time to leave the University of Toronto in the late 70s. I don't think you were aware of those particular stuff.
I have to realize during that time he was really struggling to maintain his own physical condition.
Yeah.
He was having small strokes And I think that they were much more troubling to him than we have any idea of. I mean, if you judge his humor and his frustration, the relationship between the two of them, the healthier McLuhan was, the more humorous he was.
Yes.
And the more...
he was more irritable in the late 70s.
More irritable, yeah.
Yeah. Now, let's go into what you're saying about the autism and virtualization and how it's different from Croker, because Croker okay, so you have Thompson, McLuhan, and Burroughs. Is that what I said? McLuhan, Burroughs? No, who were you a combination of? Oh, McLuhan, Watson, and Thompson. The virtualization factor, which Croker specializes in, he does not take the, whatever you call you do about virtualization. You go into brain analysis and science. He doesn't look at the autism that way. So how would you separate yourself from Croker there?
Well, let me say it this way. All virtuality is dependent upon binary digital system, whereas if we look at the organic body, it is not binary. It requires much higher levels, which can be related to analogical cognitive procedures and environmental procedures, contextual procedures, holistic procedures.
But not book or word. See, the spoken word. Not book or spoken word.
And not, yes, that's right. Not necessarily even symbolic, although I don't want to really get into that.
Yeah.
But if you have those higher levels, then you can move into the Cartesian binary world of the haves and the have-nots, you know, of the digital binary codes.
Right.
And so what happens when we start using a digital binary system is that we obsolesce to a certain degree our analogical perceptions and conceptions, but at the same time we lose the ability to perceive and conceptualize exactly what we're doing in any true causative way. I don't know. I'm kind of getting lost here in my
right. No, that's all right. It's difficult because you're pointing to the post-word, post-book world. Now, Croker calls his scene that he's making is not postmodernism or Don Thiel's word paramodernism. It's bimodernism. So he's simulating the digital binary and pointing out the binariness of his dialectic with the term bimodernism. And he sees the oscillating back and forth in all kinds of fields and trends and fads. Basically, the binaries between the will to technology versus the will to virtuality, right? Or the genes giving up the biological world and leaping into the data sphere. So there's his dialectic. Would you say Croker is a dialectician, a grammarian, a rhetorician, or the quadrivial side, music, astronomy, math, and what is it, arithmetic, music, and geometry? Do you see him trying to be quadrivial? That would be the way you'd move out of the book world, rather than being trivial.
I really don't see him using those kinds of structures for developing his thought. I think what he does is he takes a text and then he thinks about it in his own particular terms. He's an interpreter or a person who's attempting to interpret other people's texts. And what he does is he immediately aligns that text with certain examples from our contemporary world, from the popular world, and therefore thinks that he has updated or helped to articulate the contemporary in that process. I don't know. Maybe I'm
no. Okay. So here he is. He definitely his book. He talks about the world, the virtual digital late technology, late capitalism, and the virtual world is riddled with cynicism. Kynicism. He says the cynicism came up from the bottom through Diogenes, but actually as a manual or management technique in the 20th century, it's top comes from the top. So this cynicism, Croker tries to put in a way of being not cynical. He has to have some kind of program of usefulness for his students or whoever reads his book, but he talks about it being the intelligence of artifice, or to be to go in and totally put on the data sphere and almost be hyper-cynical or manipulative. So
yeah, remember what McLuhan said. He said cynicism is cheap. McLuhan didn't consider himself a cynic. He was trying to understand cynicism sometimes, but I don't thought of himself as a cynic.
Okay. No, he wasn't. No, he puts on the cynical manipulative stance. As he says, the arts are useful for navigating in the secular world, but they're not useful for salvation. Remember, he said that to Pound in the 50s. So are you in the role, what you're advocating, moving to a post-book, environmental therapy and holistic view, perceiving, those terms you used about 3 minutes ago, are you subject to the accusation that Croker makes of McLuhan, you're still a doctor, thinking there's a diet that could be applied to people? A media diet.
Well, McLuhan thought that, in fact, you know, with his early idea of having a machine that could measure the sensory bias, you know, an early chamber of some kind that we would be able to see the synesthetic differences between languages and between cultures and all that sort of thing. So I think McLuhan was still, and his media ecology, is suggesting that there might be some kind of diet there. And that was the hopeful McLuhan, I think, still talking.
Yeah. And that always was there. And you think Croker is right to say that the human flesh is totally wiped off the global theater, even the global theater is wiped off as an extension of the will of the technology, and that we are just... we somehow got to play with the genes that have become cyber-virtualized and gone to that. You know, it's a post-Terminator situation.
Well, as soon as he gets to the point where he's talking about genes becoming virtualized. No, I understand what he means and what he's getting at, but I have trouble with it. I think that... flesh is a kind of fact, a kind of fact that we don't understand, and it's an interface between us and the rest of the world. So I have trouble with his hyperboles. I understand the point that he's making, but I think sometimes the hyperbole can't be taken too literally.
Now, that's what people used to say about McLuhan. He's extreme hyperbole.
And I agree. I agree with that, too. I don't think you could take McLuhan completely literally. And I think that he would be disturbed if you did. We'll ask Ion when he's channeling McLuhan what he...
Okay, we can do that now. We can begin, in previous sessions, we just say, Marshall McLuhan, we're assuming you're there. Should your hyperbole be taken literally? And we invite Ion to introduce McLuhan or McLuhan to respond immediately. Ion, are you there? Or McLuhan?
We be.
All right. We can ask McLuhan. Did you...
Well, you best better start with us.
Okay. So what do you have to say about virtualization, what we said about Croker, and whether McLuhan was in a position that was past what Croker was critiquing?
Well, Croker's still trying to figure it out himself. He hadn't figured it out himself. So for us to speak about Croker's indemnifiable position regarding anything seems a bit nebulous, don't you think?
Well, we do have his writings. Okay, so even McLuhan was still trying to figure out
the problem
things.
With the readings is the problem with the writing is the one that wrote the reading. How do you know the one that wrote the reading right?
Well, we don't worry about that. It's an approximation for us to think it. We're not going to try to get exact precision, which is the left hemisphere matching.
Well, unlike McLuhan, we're literal.
You said, unlike McLuhan, you're literal.
That's correct.
So right. you require to know what the person means when they write.
Well, otherwise you're just babbling. This becomes just an ongoing psychobabble of ridiculous positions that don't have any place to begin or any place to land.
Okay.
If you're going to come to some conclusion, laudable or otherwise, you got to begin somewhere. And this puffery that you bring up and then start lambasting the positions regarding the positions, you'll never arrive because you don't know where you were when you got there.
Okay, now that's for people. You're here to give people to retrieve their power. I understand.
Well,
that.
Most of them wouldn't make it this far through the conversation, but
that's
that,
right.
That remains to be seen.
But we
Zion,
are.
Zion, is it that you're here to help people retrieve their power, or is it to retrieve precision?
Is there a difference?
Mm-hmm.
No. It's all right. Number one.
Who's
it's
Jared?
All right. Develop
no,
it.
No, I concur with you that there is no difference because...
Well, then develop it.
Well, to have precision and be able to speak to exact points, exact coordinates is power.
Certainly.
Than
it's what everybody that you're trying to usher up from the unquieted destitution of exited stage right is the place that you're trying to drag them back up out of the grave, when you could be precise with the position that you're trying to insinuate or instigate or initiate or instilligate. Boy, there's a new word for you, instilligate. That's pretty fun. That you're trying to bring to, then you can use these metaphorical references that you're all so brilliant and can quote and vomit up just like a dog with a bad supper. You won't have to eat so much vomit if you'll get a position that you're trying to begin to and then build on those premises instead of every abject thought that you have ever becomes the subjugation of Marshall or Thompson or Quacker or pick one.
Okay.
It really makes no difference.
Okay, Ion. I see that Scott Taylor is attempting that in his use of science and research and trying to point out what science misses as he takes on the social autism.
We love us some Scott. He's got it. That's great. Just you can't get stuck there, and you can't use the vicissitudes to validate the platitudes or vice versa.
Right.
Okay, Scott, you can respond to that. Go ahead.
I'm enjoying it. I just, you know, this idea of power and precision. McLuhan was, of course, enjoyed very much the book The Mismeasurement of Man.
Yeah,
and,
certainly.
So precision usually relates to some kind of measurement.
Not when it's spot on. Not when it's a bullseye. When it's a bullseye, it's known. It is. See,
yeah,
and what you're trying to bring into the place, take that position of this is. Well, that's where you're missing, or not you, but that's where you're talking about them.
Right.
That's where
right.
they're missing. What they're trying to, you think they're trying to tell you something when they don't know what in the hell they were speaking about.
Well, McLuhan caught many people on that. He was at conferences in the 70s, and he'd take each panelist and say, now, what do you mean by those terms? And they usually faltered. So he did do that. He went around the
circle. Of course. If you've got a beginning place... Yes, number one.
Did McLuhan do that, though, Bob, to ferret out people who didn't have their... Like, did he make them explain themselves clearly in an effort to, like, discredit them, or was it done...
No. He would work with them. He would work with them at any level. At any level and all levels. He was just trying to get the point. You weren't going to blow smoke up his skirt tail, we can assure you that. If you're going to engage Marshall McLuhan, you better
know.
He
was challenging.
Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, he was challenging. When he did that, he was actually asking you to begin to have a conversation with him.
Sure.
And he usually did it in a pretty friendly manner.
Yeah.
Certainly.
And he was trying to make you aware of
the old great sage that's coming to cram things down my throat hole. You've already made a mistake because you agree with my complete fallacy already. And so now you're going to cram things down my throat hole, old great one. Educate me, and I will be enlightened.
So
right, and so he...
Did McLuhan feel that it was possible to reach precision and gain traction? Or that it was
never the position, never the point, never the goal. The point was to make individuals look at the ridiculous positions that they were conjuring as placements of this is where we are and now how do we move forward.
Right.
You don't know where you are, so you have no chance of forward.
Right.
And when you say we don't know where we are, he's critiquing that. When these experts came along, he wanted them to become aware of the language, the medium they were using. That's what he wanted included.
Or lack of it.
Their
limitations of the language.
Well, yes, but the medium that they're referring to, he wanted that included in the conversation. So it would oscillate between concept and percept.
So McClure was trying
Corinne
to point
just
out
finally that. Told him he was full of crap.
Corinne told that to Marshall. Now you're shifting. But we're talking about Marshall in relation to other academics or whoever showed up at his place.
And
he did a
good, see,
fine
that's,
job.
That's why you're reverberating McLuhan now. It's trying to figure out where he hit it and where he didn't, and
yeah.
the distance thereof. Well, if you're talking to him, he's going to tell you quick. You got to get to the beginning before you can find the end. Otherwise, Finneganese becomes euphoric, doesn't it?
And that's not otherwise. You don't want Finneganese to be euphoric?
Well, we don't care. Marshall didn't care. That wasn't the point. It was like, get somewhere, land, begin from there, and then you can gauge as it shifts and changes, and you create yet another body that you're going to now engage regarding, that you have to fit into the landscape, and you've got to apply. Marshall McLuhan was never concerned with how sharp his Googler was. However, today, you must have the correct engine or you're lost.
When you say McLuhan wanted you to get somewhere and start from that place.
Or at least know where you were so you can have conversation, and then indeed, it more times than not, would be meaningful. But his counterparts never quite got there. Because every time they'd get too clever by half, he was like, if you're agreeing with me, you're screwed.
Yeah, McLuhan said to me through the Evergreens that he was interested in people understanding the future by fully understanding the past, which means understanding where you got, and even the beginning, the notion of a beginning and what literate people thought was a beginning versus pre-literate. You're including that, Ion, in what you're saying here.
Yes.
Because there's no beginning for the pre-literate people.
That's correct. Which, see, and that's what Marshall was trying to say in the conversation is, you've missed the boat, and then you're concerned, and you want to engage in conversation regarding which stateroom you have. You've already missed the boat, so it really makes no difference at this stage which stateroom you didn't have.
And you agree.
If you're not going to have a new car, you might as well not have a new one, a great big one.
And you see that McLuhan was pretty leading edge in pointing this out.
Well, 100 years ago, maybe.
Right. He did say Gutenberg Galaxy was like 100 years too late.
That's right.
It should have been done before, a long time ago.
Well, because then, Scott, what you have is you have a context. That's all you're missing, if you're missing anything. That's all you're missing is a context. Because, see, if you rear-view mirror McLuhan, you aren't going to go anywhere. If you rear-view mirror McLuhan, you can't get anywhere. Because McLuhan,
in life and death, still...
Hold it, Ian, let Scott respond. Go ahead, Scott.
I'm really trying very hard to understand exactly what context is and how to create context for the general citizen of the world.
Right, you write that. That's an issue you write about.
That's what it's about. And that's where I did all my research into fringe awareness, as William James talks about it. And fringe awareness is the unconscious, semi-conscious information that we have, or experiential information that we have that helps us make up any particular context in the now, in the moment, in the precision.
Well, if it takes the conscious to abdicate a position, then they're always left wanting. And if that's what you're trying to do, wonderful, no problem. Because, see, if that's the case, fabulous. Now, develop a little more.
Ion does not accept the concept reference point consciousness or subconscious. Are you aware of that, Scott?
I know those are terribly imprecise words.
But it's all right. It's an okay position. As long as you don't get stuck there, we're with you like a bad habit.
No, they're just categories of thought. And it's really hard for us to decide exactly what thought is
Well, us too. We think we say never mind. We're with you.
So that, then going back to last week's discussion on memory, and it relating to mnemonics and minding something or remembering.
Mnemonics are nothing other than the angle.
Yeah. Nothing other than the what?
The angle.
Angle. You're in the wind, Bob.
Okay, now I'm away. Go ahead. Develop that, Scott or Ryan, about the angle.
Scott's up. He's good.
Well, you know, I think that the category that they discuss in most of the neurosciences regarding memory is really ridiculous.
It is.
First of all, they
it's
limit
spot
it.
Spot on. Good. Okay, now, wait. Hold up a second, Now, we agree. Now, develop that. You want
to
play with Marshall McLuhan?
That's what I'm trying to do.
Develop that structure from that context. That's good.
Yeah, well, we use our whole bodies, and in fact, we use the whole environment in terms of our mnemonic or memory skills. And one of the things that I would say that for McLuhan, there was no such thing as a pure hierarchy. There was an embedded hierarchy. Do you know what I mean?
Do.
So when you are trying to perceive something, what you do is you move as best you can into the embodied or embedded hierarchy. And,
until you achieve a stasis or a place of knowing, and then you forget all those.
Right.
Good.
And when you achieve that, that's where you start wrestling with God.
We don't.
You know, Simone Weil talks about that as a way of knowing. And
who does? Who does?
Simone Weil.
Simone Weil, W-E-I-L-L, right.
W-E-I-L.
We don't.
Yeah.
We don't see, because the essence of what you're saying, which is perfect words, because it brings it into actual, an actual context that you can embrace. And it's not theoretical either, because Chad's got slobber dripping off his eye teeth ready to jump on this, but that's okay, because we can work with this from this context. You speak of wrestling with God, or Simone does, fine, but then once you know that, you see, then the battle's over. That's the point. The autonomic responses within the human meat sack, the human form. Now, you're bringing up memory. Okay. We're not going to fight you. It's all right. No problem. The point of that is that if you allow the body to autonomically respond, which it does, we have proof. You know, hold your breath
until
you pass out. When
does.
You hit the ground, you're going to start breathing. Whether you remember to breathe or not, you are.
Right.
Good. Mm-hmm. Well, the same thing is this battle that you come with cognitive thought. See, it's every single time without failure exception, too clever by half. Because what happens is you have to think, or what we say, to soften the whole thing. But now, granted, we kind of go at it a glib position softly here, that this thing called living is not a thinking man's game, okay? You can think yourself into anything or out of anything. Then you create a belief system, which is nothing other than thoughts you've been thinking a long time.
Right. What were you going to say about cognitive? Don't keep explaining yourself too much. What were you going to say about cognitive? I mean, you're saying it, but you were starting to address his language.
Mm-hmm. The cognitive experience that you gauge from a validatable or validating belief system is always flawed, because you can change a belief.
Are you saying that there's no ground to think about thought? Is that
correct.
What you're saying?
Thought doesn't think. Right.
More dissociative that you are, the more you move into conscious forms of thinking, and the more you move into visual forms of thinking, the more unconscious that you become, the more you move into autonomic ways of thinking. In terms of the treatment of multiple personality disorder or of dissociative.
Well, dissociative.
You know where
we
I'm
like
going?
That better because we don't really call. Because you got to remember, you know what we're going to say at that point. We're going to say yes, and genius is also a disorder compared.
Right, but let's Scott finish your sentence. You were saying the multiple.
Well, what I was going to say is that when they're involved in therapy, which is usually a therapy involving, dialogue and verbal phenomenology, they can always move to an individual or a dissociated portion and a more autonomic portion of the person who knows, for want of another word, the truth of the whole process of dissociation. And how I tend to think of McLuhan is certainly not as a multiple personality disorder, but as somebody who was able to actually continually to get in touch with that part of the autonomic, which allowed him to understand the context of his experience, and therefore relatively, and metaphorically and analogically, the context of other people's experience accordingly.
You like those words, Ian?
From his position.
You would add that, or you like what his position is?
Oh, no.
Okay, now, so what do you mean by from his position? From McLuhan's position or Scott's position?
From Scott's position. It's an okay place to begin, but if you keep going on that trail, then the next thing you know, it's going to take your ego to activate your autonomic responses if you keep going down that thread.
No. I don't try to move in that direction.
Good.
But
if you keep going, that's where you land up, you see. No one ever starts off to end up in a mud hole. But what we're telling you is, if you keep going, you're gonna get mud on your pretty shiny shoes.
Because he kept saying words, and Scott's aware of that. He could have stopped on a dime at any point of what he was saying.
No problem. Because now, Scott, look at how you are able. Take it apart. Look at how you're able to see the obsolescence and the retrieval of all these ones within your empirical searching.
You're not obsolescing or retrieving anything when you move into the direct autonomic connection with the rest of the mindscape or the universal around
you.
But
an autonomic response wouldn't be inclusive of the mindscape, so then that nullifies your conversation if you keep that going, you see.
Yeah, I'm not worried about remaining Scott per se. In a lot of ways, I'll be very, very happy to leave Scott way, way, way behind.
Well, we want Scott way, way, way ahead.
Well, okay.
You see, that's the position. See, that's the position. Because we'd say develop it the way you want it to be and lay it out and say, I'm God and this is the way it is.
No, I don't want anybody else to necessarily move, but I would like them to understand.
Understanding is what you do when you climb up under something and try to stand up. You just end up with a sore head.
You bump the ceiling when you stand under
when
something.
When you climb under something and try to stand up to understand, you just get a sore head.
So you prefer the term overlaying?
Well, it's all right. But what we're trying to get to is what Marshall McLuhan, William, well, just start. You could take them all and put them in a shoebox, the fullness of all of them, and put them in a shoebox. And at the end of the day, what you're going to find that they were trying to convey was, until you come into a place where this position that you're describing and discussing, and you're doing a beautiful job, we ain't fussing, all's well. At the end of the day, the whole point is you gauge this elemental construct you call and they call time. It's nullified. All right. Now, if you get rid of time, now all of a sudden, your essence of the spoken word that you engage becomes the essence of what you call creation. And the simple, and they fought, and they'd scream and holler and smoke things and drink things and lick things. They did all kinds of things. It was great fun.
You mentioned McLuhan and William. Are you talking about Burroughs or James or both? Or
Lewis.
Thompson?
Lewis.
Wyndham Lewis. Okay, Wyndham Lewis. Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Because, see, that's what most of that was pripped up, propped and ripped, pripped up by.
Lewis.
Yeah, of course. It became, for Marshall, it became the great validator, because that's all he was trying to do, was validate.
What he got out of Lewis.
And or every other step along the way.
Oh, those two.
Of course.
Well, did Marshall favor Lewis over Joyce or neither?
Neither.
Okay.
Well. No. Wait. Now he would honor the Joycean rendition only because it made new fodder to play with.
Yeah.
It was new sand in the sandbox. Is all.
Now that's true, Scott. One thing about McLuhan is you'd go to his office or his seminar table and you'd see all the latest books. He was always looking for new stuff to play with, to bash around, to retrieve the ancient. Do you know what I mean, Scott? Did you notice that?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So I agree with Ion there that he was.
But I'm still have to use words when I talk to you.
You're all right. We're with you.
Universe of discourse, rather. And
all right.
Yeah, and I recognize what you're trying to say to me, and I try to heed it and have tried to heed it.
Mm-hmm.
But McLuhan was very critical of Wyndham Lewis too. I don't think he was particularly enamored with Lewis.
Well, that's what Ion just said, that McLuhan didn't favor either. That's what.
Yeah, but especially right. not yeah. Lewis. It became the reason for him to have something to say.
Hmm.
In other words, he wasn't enamored with Lewis, but Lewis gave him something to bounce
right.
off, like counterblast. Okay, so when you were describing about making the creation, the word, using the word to create, that seems to me what Scott is saying is retrieve the analogical, not in the book sense, but in a new sense, and maybe bring in precision. What you're
define analogical.
Pardon
yeah.
me?
Yes, yeah, Scott, define.
No, Bob used it. Define
yeah.
analogical, Bob.
I'm using it the way...
We don't care
Scott,
what you use.
No. I'm using it the way... Listen, I know what Scott says about the digital and the analogical, and he sees the weakening of the analogical. But Scott doesn't want to go into the Croker digital embracement. He thinks
no,
there's a way to retrieve the analogical in a new way. And I find the way Ion describes the creative powers of the word that would bring you into your power is what Scott sees as valuable in the analogical. Now, do you agree with that, Scott, what I just said?
Yeah, to a certain degree.
Yeah.
So now, yeah. Bob, as we said, define it.
An analogy is the perception of the distance between you and you and a couple of others and the medium you're using. So we're talking quadraphenic distances. And then you can bring in the cosine and sine waves to measure it. And that, what I just said, is a bunch of words articulating a living being that's not included by the words I just said. That's what analogy is. It's a living presence.
But you didn't say an analogy. You said antilogical.
Oh, no, I didn't. You heard. No, I never meant that. I didn't mean. I meant analogical, not anti. I didn't mean that.
Exactly. That's the, and we're literal.
You heard anti-logical, and you're asking me to define anti-logical.
And the press has stopped right there, Scott. I'm like, oh, hell no.
Anti-logical,
oh,
no. You misheard me. But I'm glad you did, because I got to say some interesting stuff in response.
So now when you go back and re-unhear yourself later, you're like, gosh, it really did sound like that. Okay. So
yes,
good.
It did.
So,
it was a subtext of anti-logical.
So that's, and we were okay with that, but we weren't going one step further until you cleaned
yeah.
it up, because then everything after that, which, like you said, was just a whole bunch of words, didn't mean
yeah,
anything.
Which is what I do and what McLuhan did. He would stop you if you were going to go off the tracks, or at least he'd find out what tracks you're jumping off to.
That's right. And if you didn't know, then there was no reason for you to continue on
yeah.
with your psychotropic bibble babble.
Yeah, you see that, right, Scott? You know that's what McLuhan was. That's the grammarian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's what you're gauging
like to,
it by.
Just clear
so it's beautiful.
Up
go ahead.
About,
hold it, Ion. Scott's saying something.
I'd just like to clear up a little bit something of my perception about the nature of time. And William James said something, it was one of his maxims, that to leave something out was the beginning of the end. He was all-inclusive. And so I see time as part of maybe 247 different dimensions. And so you have to, in fact, incorporate it for all of the rest to make sense. And
yet it doesn't.
Pardon?
And yet it doesn't.
And yet it doesn't. You're right, right there, too. It moves beyond what we would consider sensible categories.
Well, we can inframe. It's that's what I meant by the living analogy. The living.
Okay.
It's
So if your world, right. if your world is possible to be timeless or without time, the construct of time. I mean, you humans created it. Okay. So if there could be a way to work in your same world with no time, no eras, no millennia, no copyright marks, no beginning, no time, that everything that is in your now, would that change the direction of your words? So that
yeah,
makes
well,
sense
one
anyway.
Tries, one tries, in fact, to both embrace that and to let it go at the same time.
Well,
but,
okay, that's interesting, but you, and we hear you, and that's an okay place, but yet at the end of the day, you can spend the rest of eternity, and this is fun, you can spend the rest of eternity proving time, and at the end of eternity, which doesn't end, you'll still be right where you were when you began.
Yeah,
that's
I don't
Marshall
need
to
prove
to
time.
Say. Okay, then to obsolesce it, well, physicists, oh, that's great fun. Yeah, they're tangled up these days because now everything they've built their entire strata on now is out the
right.
window now.
Yeah.
E don't meet MC squared no more. Interesting,
that's
isn't
right.
it? So now just in the true realm of McLuhan, you have obsolesced yourself into a new place that nullifies the very statue that got you on the stage in the first
but
place.
But Ion, you know perfectly well
we
that
do.
People who think like McLuhan and to some degree myself and our good host here recognized that the speed of light was never the limit. And
it's not even 186,000 miles per second either.
Probably not.
Hey, Scott, I want to say something. Ion was very precise. As I was talking, I was thinking, oh, yeah, McLuhan said in Gutenberg Galaxy that E equals MC squared was a sculptural artifact. And as I'm getting ready to say it, Ion says, blah, 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 Einstein, to bring your statue on stage that you work with. He said it right there, statue sculptural. And McLuhan was showing the limitations of E equals MC squared with that categorization.
Yeah, that's right.
Which,
and
is,
that's
the, which is the essence of
idea.
What all physics began to. So
right.
so they're all way their sheepskins just lost a great deal of value lately.
Yeah,
so now
yeah.
let's get you somewhere. We like your words, okay? So now let's get it somewhere. Otherwise, it's for naught. And your whole point of even having the interaction, because it's beautiful. You want to validate your research, and we say great. Get it from a position that you can...
No, I want to communicate it. I find communication as a kind of validation. But
then it's still validation, still the case,
yeah,
then,
I understand
isn't it?
That. Having a little bit of trouble with the words. It's
all right. That's all right.
More than validation,
hey,
nobody
Scott,
ever understands what
Scott,
you really mean.
Scott, us too. We don't get that you want to communicate something that you're figuring out, and because it doesn't seem logical to us, being literal doesn't seem logical to us. We would much rather, and this is what we do, we get the position that is, and we go from that knowing. Okay? Now, if you're not sure, then you don't know. Then leave that part alone. That's the part you're developing. But get
yeah,
the part,
I mean,
any syntax that you can embrace that you know Not that you've thought about a long time, not that somebody else thunk a thought that
right.
got to thinking
right.
and the thinking thought
right.
got thunk. Forget all that
right.
noise, because it'll end in tears, just like it did for McLuhan.
Right.
Okay? So get a point
yeah.
that works, any construct, and say, nope, this is it. This is it. All right? And begin from that place, and then any dichotomy that comes along that you want to play with and engage, you can from that construct. But
yeah.
but you and
well now
you
Scott does
simple.
Have a construct. The way you're saying it, I think Scott has a construct
yeah.
he's working with.
We,
what would you
yeah.
say? Could you yeah. can you use words to say what it is, Scott? The knowing
in that
thing.
Company, I'd rather not.
That's
it hasn't been patented yet.
I had a wonderful experience with McLuhan. We were once walking in the rain, and he asked me, by the way, what was I reading? And I was reading Canetti's Crowds and Power. So he said, well, you know, what does Canetti say? And so I gave him a kind of synopsis and, or overview. And
uh-huh.
when I was finished, McLuhan stopped, and he looked at me very seriously, and he said, now, Scott, that is a model, and every time you see a model, you break it.
Very
so,
good.
I think that, yeah.
Very good. Very good, because when you do that, then you know. If it's if you break it and it's unbreakable, that's a benchmark. Scholars everywhere will listen, and then you'll have something to communicate when that is the case, you see.
Well, he did, so that's why McLuhan still resonates. It may end it in tears for him personally, but he did come up with a model that was pretty unbreakable. Would you agree with that? And that included the breaking of it, what he told Scott. See,
well,
that's
great,
what,
great. Wonderful, but see, at the end of the day, you got to convince him, the creator of that, and he was not.
He was not convinced.
Correct.
Could you have McLuhan, could we have some McLuhan, we could ask him directly what his view, because we're hearing Ion's view.
Well, and
all right. So McLuhan, what model did you have and then break?
All of them.
Yeah, you were encyclopedic, that's true. You can develop that, Scott. Respond to that.
Well, McLuhan and I had a conversation
yes.
about something that
yes.
was
now,
he's
we're
right there,
third,
Scott. So you can
we're not third
hello
person.
There.
Hello, yes, hello.
And Mildred said hello.
Hello. Hello back, loud and clear. McLuhan, do you remember when it came out the debate on non-periodic tiling? Or the notion that any geometric form or figure that one starts with, if you send it out on a trajectory through space and time, it will change into every other geometric form. You know, this is part
before
of
before it returns back to what it was known as when it departed. Yes.
Right. Okay. So what I was trying to get at with my comment about your idea to break all of the models was this movement into an analogical, open-ended form related to periodic tiling.
Hold on. The essence of breaking the mold ends up in originality. If it is original, and it is original, and it is original, with an extra L's, ever how many you want to put, if it's indeed original, then you broke the mold, okay? Then
right.
it doesn't become a constant resurging regurgitation regarding the outcome of the originality of the thing that was not, that now is.
Okay, so... you, as in my understanding, were more interested in the Aristotelian and the Aristotelian causes than you were in terms of the Platonic forms. And so,
well, because the Platonic form was fleeting, always. When you get
yeah,
locked into the Platonic form, you're stuck. You marry a woman, you don't want her to change, and she does. She marries you thinking she's going to change you, and
right.
you don't.
Right.
There you go.
Can you put words for me into Aristotle's mouth about what he would say about that? I mean, I know he said that he preferred the truth to Plato, but
well, he preferred masturbation to Homer too, but that's all right.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So what terms could Scott use to make the point about Plato from an Aristotelian position? Would you
right,
say,
that's
Marshall?
That's what I'm asking. Thanks.
Master the obfuscation. Master
right.
the obfuscation. And if you do that,
right.
Your work will be read.
Okay.
And Marshall, you mastered the obfuscations of your time.
Certainly. Well, you'd say yes, and yet you're still babbling about them, so maybe not.
Right. Yeah, in other words, we didn't get your message.
Apparently not.
So is that why it ended in tears? Because we didn't get your message, or is there something personal?
As soon as I figure it out, I'll let you know.
Well, what did end in tears for you?
The whole die in the codomy that was trying to be simply laid out is to make you question and look at the things that are very obvious. It's very obvious to me, but no one else seemed to get it. We'd say you're not listening to the radio. The radio's listening to you.
Right. So in this centenary year, you're not impressed, I assume, with the commentators and panels on your work.
Yeah, they are common for sure.
What do you make of what we're trying here in Maui? Are we failing miserably, or at least attempting something approaching originality? Bringing you in as a
originality. Interesting. That's a that.
Okay,
approaching
original. Originalness.
Not so.
Okay,
much
so yet. Bringing you in is original.
Well, if you were going to take something and build to it, and you break the mold, your five bodies don't hold soup. You get that, don't you?
Yeah, we're moving towards the hexadic and the octave.
Well, fabulous, but until you break that mold, you see, you fought fire for all this, what you call time, to thoroughly, completely establish the five bodies, only to find out that you were peeing in the wind.
No, not true. The merging of the five bodies.
Wait.
Let's be more precise. The merging of the five bodies, which I talked about occasionally in the last decade, evoked the merger.
You're welcome.
Yeah, so it was successful. It was a means to an end.
And fleeting,
yes. So anyways, if you put the term five body into a website or into a paper, it gets a fossilization. But I certainly didn't recommend that fossilization. It was a way of making conversation, just like Eric and Marshall, tossed out the dialectic of hot and cool a year after it was popularized in the mid-60s.
Certainly. It was ridiculous.
It was fleeting. And yet it's what you get in the panelists and scholars today are still trying to figure out what hot and cool meant. And apply it today and miss the process of awareness, or the awareness of process that McLuhan was pointing out.
It was a terrible waste of good bourbon.
So when I bring up the five bodies, that's a way of subsuming what Croker did, what Baudrillard did, what LaRouche did, what McLuhan did, with some new terms to create a stimulus. But certainly it's not something that's meant to be put in stone. It's, if you notice, other people make these websites. I don't.
Well, yes, because you don't do anything.
Right. I'm staying with the fleeting. So,
okay.
And then we got something really fleeting but solid with your completion. Because what's interesting, Scott, is Ion says that Ion completes Finnegan's Wake, completes McLuhan, completes Zappa, completes a lot of the great artists. Do you complete William Burroughs, Ion? Now I'm switching back to Ion, not McLuhan.
Well, the parts that are completable, yeah.
Okay,
the parts
well,
that are completable, because there's some of that is just gibberish.
Would you say the same for Finnegan's Wake?
Nope.
That's interesting, Scott.
We've given it to you, but you don't know the cipher. So until you
there's
know
this Playfair cipher for Finnegan's Wake.
Playfair cipher. Until you get the Playfair cipher, you don't have a clue.
Now, here's what's interesting, Scott. The Playfair cipher is not something Joyce put in there. but is something non-physical put in there? What do you think of that, Scott?
Well, I understand it to a certain degree. I can see that that's certainly there. But I want to get back to ask McLuhan a question.
Okay,
go
ahead.
On my tangent on the Aristotelian causes.
Yes.
So there,
yeah.
There are four causes: efficient, formal, final, and material. And they make up two figures and two grounds. So automatically,
yes, but once they're obsolesced, define the retrieval.
Hello, are we still on?
Yeah.
Once they're obsolesced, define the retrieval.
Well, let him work towards that. Let him state his point first.
I'm not sure that anything is completely obsolete ever.
Then it is not. Then what you're speaking of is not. You must be able to break the molds to call it original, and that's what you're trying to do.
You're saying everything is completely obsolete, is what you're saying.
Otherwise, it isn't retrievable.
Has to be completely obsolete.
I understand in certain ways what you're saying. Each individual is in a way original, and yet we have epigenetics, which show that the whole stream of life going back from when it was first formulated on Earth. I mean, if we look at a more standard scientific model. But anyway, let me just go back here for a second. So we have the four Aristotelian causes, and the efficient cause relates to power and to potential and to the means of something and has an allegorical kind of signification. The formal cause is related to the actual, the utilitarian cause, and is related more to the literal. The final cause is related to the ends, which are the purpose. And if I remember correctly, you used to think of that in terms of the analogical, in terms of...
anthropomorphic. Anthropomorphic.
Okay, I get it. Right. I may have even written that down wrong. And then the material relates to form, and it is always...
position of location, not form. Position of location. Your constructs will work if you place them in a beginning place, but there's this nebulosity of congruent angles that are going to somehow mystically line themselves up for an outcome. It seems a bit preposterous, don't you think?
Marshall, give an example of a beginning point.
You're going to paint a painting, okay? A beginning point would be somewhere within a preset canvas that had a construct where the canvas was and then where the canvas was not, and that you were going to confine your abstract within the parameters that you gauge. Makes no difference the size that you gauge. And then that beginning point would be the exact precise distance from every angle that you include in your abstract that makes the construct of where the beginning is. And if you go that way, then there'll be no end. If you begin
so you mean
from
the first
that place,
point that I put my paintbrush onto the canvas?
Then there'll be no end.
So I have this point where I put the brush on the canvas. I make...
That's the beginning?
Where that was, and that's the beginning.
Certainly, because the medium is the message, isn't it?
Okay, but why will there be no end?
Because you'll never complete it. Joyce didn't.
Okay, but are you saying that the way that most of these critical scholars go about their discourse...
They're doing
it
in the rearview mirror, and they're ridiculous, and they don't even know what the hell they're talking about.
So they don't have a starting point?
Nope, they're all borrowing it from someone else's unconcluded, unmold, broken, nebulous, satirical position.
Right, so that's what you meant, Marshall, by begin with percept, not concept.
Otherwise, you're lost. Otherwise, you'll find yourself 100 years later agreeing with our own fallacies.
Yeah, and that's part of the Socratic dialectic, the first part of it.
And that's what the whole point of this is, that it's a bit ridiculous when you get it down to the lowest common denominator. Everybody's got an opinion and a construct and something they're trying to cram down your throat hole, and they're going to wake up the soulless mind and try to obfuscate the very mass that's going to bring them into some kind of position that they can gauge their reality regarding. And until you begin, until it marks, you can come against anything if you know where you began. Then you always can break the mold. Well, if you can break the mold, then originality is yours.
So you back to the material cause. Pursue that a little more, Scott. You didn't. I interrupted.
Well, what I would like to then look at is Aristotelian poetics, his poetics, and as I understood it, Aristotle tended to think of rhetoric as efficient. Cause related to power and potential and the means, whereas poetry had in it all four causes, and as a result
then place iambic pentameter in that very construct.
Yeah, you did that before. We've had this conversation in class. Yeah.
Yes. Exactly. Okay. Welcome back.
Okay. Well, that would relate, of course, to the five senses and the five divisions of rhetoric. So you move back to the efficiency of it.
Because then the code that you're trying to draw conclusions against, by very definition, is nullified. Well, if that's breaking the mold and that's the way you want to go at it, just like before, fine, but you can't use these words to set this as the positional place that you're going to draw the conclusion regarding, when you can't even fit the forms of poetry, or if you can fit the forms of poetry in Aristotelian views, then you see one or the other can't apply.
Yeah, I actually have learned that. It's just I'm not sure how to apply it in a way that is convivial with the rest of the community I find myself in.
Well, don't worry about your community. If you start worrying about your community, you'll blow your brains out because you'll never be there.
Yeah, isn't that the truth?
Get your world to suit you, and then everybody else will capitulate to you. It's all I've ever done.
Yeah. Okay.
Till you get it with you, everyone's going to be able to pick it apart. But once you set it and make it so, and it's your own, then piss on them. They'll figure it out or not.
Yeah. Well, more of that pissing on comes with age.
Well, if there were only time.
If there were only time.
Okay, McLuhan. Baudrillard said you're a musician. I like to translate that into you worked with the trivial in the electric age, not so much you worked with the quadrivium, music, astronomy, math, music, geometry, arithmetic, and astronomy.
We worked with the distance between each of those.
Right,
in
the interval.
One of those. The interval between all of those or any of those, that's where
More the musician, as you define music. It's in the gap.
Well, everything is a half-step modulation until you modulate it, isn't it?
Yeah, you wrote to Innes in 51 that you're not into amplitude modulation, but frequency modulation.
Most certainly. Because
that's what you're talking about.
Because otherwise, it'll never be a perfect tone. Tonality has to do with where you are in contraspect to the reverberation of the frequency in the first place. That's why you can have a piece of music and 100 people in a different perspective hear it 100 different ways, and it's the same music. You can even take it and put it on a Victrola and play it again, and yet it changes again. It's the
now. Did John Cage understand this, McLuhan? Marshall?
Oh,
did
for
John?
Pete's sake, no.
He didn't get whatever you were pointing out.
Never.
I just wanted to point something out that's opposite.
No, wait. Just a minute, Chad. Let's Scott. Follow up, Scott. What were you going to say?
What did you think of the Book of Changes? What do you think about the Book of Changes, which was so much part of the accidental musicality of Cage? And I'm interested in it from a Chinese cultural and Buddhist perspective.
Well, okay. See, the perspective affects the frequency and its outcome. That's the point.
Got it.
And the issue is it's always short. It never gets you there. It's
right.
kind of like early pornography. It was pretty exciting until you got to the end of the page and there wasn't much left there. There wasn't much to move you beyond it, you see.
Right.
It was just the vaudeville version of human sexuality.
Yeah. It goes right back to yin yang and all that in terms of
perfect.
Human sexuality.
Perfect. I mean, if you want to look real close, you can go in and actually have your pornography going into the inside of a pap smear if you're interested in the female form. Well, you can get down to the fallopian tubes, and they won't be quite erotic at all. And yet, that's the essence of where the eroticism is achieved.
Yeah, that's beautiful. and the
you get to that place, you do that from an anatomically correct place, and you won't sell much pornography, we assure you.
Yeah, Baudrillard McLuhan called this increasing high definition of body parts and processes as obscenity. Would you agree with that?
There is
not
no
obscenity in the religious sense, but
no,
the exposure of everything.
There is no obscene. It's
you
relative.
Don't see an obscene.
That's relative.
Right.
Back in the day, if you saw a woman's ankles, that was obscene.
Right.
So it's relative. Chad, you were chopped off.
We're going to mention Zappa,
yeah.
Chad? Are you going to mention Zappa, Chad?
Yes.
Okay, we do not allow Ion's personal oppression of Zappa. I'm hoping that Ion will address. Go ahead.
This is from McLuhan. It was just back to that earlier point about having a starting point and using the example of the canvas and knowing where the canvas is and where it isn't. I just wanted to read this quick few points from Zappa because this really sounds like Zappa's definition of composing. So
no, it is, but you're saying it sounds like what Ion's saying or McLuhan.
McLuhan,
he's trying
yeah.
to soften it so that Ion doesn't bust something non-physically.
But yeah, Ion gets upset when you talk about Zappa, but Ion did say that Zappa's music was technically made to be heard today with more advanced equipment.
Well, you're going to queer the conversation.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead,
Chad. Does Marshall concur with Zappa's definition of composing, which is this? One, declare your intention to create a composition. Two, start a piece at any time. Three, cause something to happen over a period of time. It doesn't matter what happens in your time hole. We have critics to tell us whether it's any good or not, so we don't worry about that part. Number four, end the piece at some time or keep going, telling the audience it's a work in progress.
Very good. That works. That works. That works. What's missing or what's shifting or what's when you are a creator, a composer who isn't composing. And if you tell them that it's a work in progress, then you're a composer wannabe, are you not?
Yeah.
Okay. If you have a beginning point and you have an ending point, then you would, before you begin, you'd know you were done.
Right.
Okay. If you can begin at any place, very good, then there is no beginning and there is no end. It just all becomes ramblings, and there's no problem there. There's no problem there. But few can engage with every outcome that we've laid out for you right here, and call themselves a very complacent, deliciously, happily vindicated composers of marvelous compositions. But now you don't have to start with Zappa. You can go to Beethoven and have the same conversation.
But you're saying it's, in your opinion, Marshall, it's not important to have the end point, but to have the beginning point.
That's correct, because until you set the key, it'll never be in on pitch.
Okay. And in the case of the type of work that Croker and yourself did, which is the Croker with his critical theory and you with your media observations, what equates to key, setting a key?
The protagonist view of antagonation. Did you get that,
so,
Scott? Antagonation.
Yes, yeah. I got it.
Yeah.
All of the conversation around it.
The protagonist view of antagonation. Very good. Number one, is that what Ion calls you these days?
And that's, thank you, I think. And
yes.
That's what how you, McLuhan, saw Odysseus to a certain degree.
Certainly.
Certainly. Yeah.
And we didn't have issue or problem with it. It's just that's what it was. No problem. No problem. If you know that and you can embrace it at that level, it's great fun. You can have much conversation regarding it.
So a music that has a beginning or a key or a tonic but no end, that's the lost chord.
It would be.
Could you think of it that way?
It is. We wouldn't think of it. It is.
Okay.
And that breaks the mold because that's original.
Yeah.
Very good.
Do you still think that it was appropriate for you to concentrate on frequency, since frequency is the speed at which matter vibrates? You weren't really interested, were you, in you were interested in understanding speed and speed up, but you weren't interested in burning down the house.
Well, now the house burned anyway. Okay.
Right.
Burned anyway. So looking at it from this perspective, then frequency was the key. Frequency was the key.
It is always,
now,
yeah.
Well, because the period or the amplitude has a great deal to do with it, with its precarious, vicarious outcome. Frequency can shatter cement. Frequency can knock down blow the door
when
off the most secure vault.
When the mode of music changes, the walls of the city crumble. Euripides.
Indeed.
Yeah. Okay. What is the relationship of a key or a tonic to tone, to resonation? Or is the tone something that is imbued by the singer of the song?
No. The song sings the singer. Not the other way around.
Yeah.
The hertz frequency that the song is. Now, you get this, because there's some music that some great, even opera, high opera singers can't reach. Okay?
Right.
So the song sings the singer. Now, if they're able to achieve the song, then it's beautiful. It's on pitch. It's in chord. It's great. If they can't, you could have greater appreciation of pouring water on a cat.
Yeah. Can I ask a rather delicate question? And that is, have you gained much more information about musics or musiki since your passing?
The obvious is yes, because now the lines and spaces aren't nearly as blurred as they were.
Okay.
Now you pick that apart and you'll get what we mean.
That's extremely humble of you to say, McLuhan. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So are you listening with greater precision now? Is that what you mean?
We're hearing for the first time.
Right. Well, I'm really, really glad to hear that.
But Marshall, your work may not help us today
get to hear for the first time and stay in the physical. Hold it. And stay in the physical.
It didn't help you then either, so
right.
welcome to our world.
What, do you, Marshall, prefer us to hear what you're hearing now and remain in the physical and not have to transition?
Well, you're constantly in this battle of deciding or deciphering your position. We say your position is just from your beginning place if you began, so therefore your ending is up to you as well. So it makes no difference. As a bird flies, it makes no difference. You haven't even figured out the difference between the medium and the message. How are you going to decide which position is going to be closest to what we would suggest you to look forward to?
To stay in the physical, all for the purpose of staying in the physical.
Well, exactly. And yet you still pine and ponder over whether or not the medium indeed is the message.
Okay, there's been a million words written about that. What
factor
are we not considering? Are there factors we're not considering in that dialectic, or whatever you're saying it is?
Well, certainly.
Could you indicate the factors we're not considering?
Develop what you know. What is the medium, Bob? What is the message? And it'll be very obvious.
Okay, you take this medium. It's a free conference call. So we have digital phones, digital satellites, I don't know, fiber optics, to meet in one place that anybody can access. And then it can be recorded and heard again. You have said the instant replay is the most profound technological innovation in its effects on people. Do you see that instant replay effect of this early 70s superseded by even more profound effect now?
Because everything is constantly marked as a beginning place and an ending place, but in the what you call the TiVoed position,
yeah,
it is now neither. It
right.
doesn't begin nor does it end.
Exactly.
It becomes a constant loop. Hyper.
Yeah.
Hyper, this is going to be
fun. Shepherd's tone.
Yeah, very good, very good.
What's the shepherd's tone, Scott?
It's a constant loop in music.
Right, now you've written and pointed out this loopiness, haven't you, Scott?
I haven't dealt with that form exactly.
You will.
I would hope that anybody that read me, though, was able to do that. I mean, that is the great benefit of one's writings in that fact that the reader can
loop back. See, there's your trouble. They're not going to read you, Scott. You have to read them. That's the point.
Yeah, I get that, too.
But we're trying to figure
yeah,
out
I'm
whether
sure
it's better
to
stay
it.
Or not to stay. And the very essence that we spent 100 years trying to get to, at least get to you, and here we are again, Bob. That's the point. You can't worry about the process until you get the destination, and even the destination, you never get there until you figure out the process of the actual journey that you're trying to ensue.
Right. So this looping point he's made, Scott, is very, very useful for us. That's Marshall up to date, right?
Scott.
That's Marshall giving us you were getting glimpses of that, but he just defined the nature of the Android meme right now.
Yeah, the thing is that every time it loops, it's something different, which is
exactly.
Also, yeah, and so nothing happens the same way twice.
Yeah, so Scott, when he said obsolescence.
And yet, in its retrieval, which is what Bob was going to strangely try to break something from, in the retrieval, what you find is the new thing. You almost can't tell from the old thing that you'd obsolesce from in the beginning place.
That's right.
Yeah, that's how I understood that obsolescence has to be the completion of the thing, because what the retrieval is nowhere like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be finished, what's obsolesced.
So if you looked at it from our perspective, if you began from what you'd obsolesced and retrieved, you can have what it's going to be before it is, and then deconstruct it to the point that you got the essence of what it was, and then you wouldn't have to go around the mountain a million times to figure out how it is.
Yeah, so when we ascend or arrive at our physical eternity, We are retrieving something that is not apparent to anybody right now because it was obsolete so much when people fell with the Ark of the Covenant. We're going to retrieve a state that always is, but it's nothing like what was obsolete, which was the immortal flesh.
To every season, there is a time. It's the time and now.
Well, that's interesting. What would you quibble with those words? To every season, there is a time?
Yeah, to every season lacks an arnest.
To every season, there is a timing? A better way to say it.
No. There is no time. So seasons are not timed. They don't last the same amount. They don't start at the same time.
I was referring to the biblical quote.
You didn't get the construct.
All
of the
wanted
quote.
To emphasize was the is. In other words.
Well, is. There's everything is. Now, arness has to do with whether it's real for you. Okay. Scott is. But we're interested in Scott R.
Yeah. But Scott is also Schrodinger's cat. How do you work with that? Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Both living and dead at the same time. There is very little differentiation, really.
Well, when there's no time, then there's no death. We like that better.
Right. Okay.
What once was dead is live again.
Yeah, but modern.
The scriptures also say that Jesus wept because of the death of Lazarus, and yet he was called forth. What once was dead is now alive.
Brilliant.
Right. In modern 20th century physics, going back to the Copenhagen Conference or before, they forever got themselves in the knots of wrestling with time or the Schrodinger's cat. They included time or the dead. They could not take, they don't get funding if they announce that there is no death. And they're beginning to see that in CERN right now, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
And all they could come up with is announce equals MC squared is
We're going to do the cat where you put it in the box, you kill it, and then you open the box and the damn cat's alive. That'll solve that shit, won't it?
Okay. I'm thinking about something. So this instant continuum of instant replay involves itself in entrainment. It's a kind of rhythm.
It's social perception.
Yeah, that's true.
Social perception.
Yeah. I see perception as kind of that point where you begin to paint from.
Well, that's anthropomorphic.
How do you work with apperception?
Well, because of your visual bias. You're gauging the outcome of the painting, and you hadn't even got your brush wet yet.
Okay, that's really good. Thank you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As my friend Durante always said, we got a million of them. Chad?
I'm just looking at that shepherd tone that Scott brought up, and I've actually seen this before. It's like a barber's pole, but represented acoustically.
Yeah.
The way that the bands go on a barber's pole, the barber's pole is turning, but the bands appear to be going up higher infinitely.
Yes.
And I was wondering if that is a way of seeing how we have an illusion of that there's time. Is that an appropriate symbol?
Well, you've got to go to the barber's pole, and it wasn't to go get a haircut, it was the blood letters. So the reason that it had that visual bias was that the blood would flow. Actually, that was the pole doesn't make it to look as it's going up. It was the other direction. Is that blood would be let out, is the point.
Okay, so the idea of blood or water flowing, humans normally impose an idea of time onto that it flows.
Not necessarily. Here's the thing. Let's say you go and you donate a pint of blood. Okay, you go and you lay down and they stick your arm, they got a little butterfly or a pretty good gauge needle, and you fill a sack. Well, takes you 15 minutes. Well, someone else comes and they fill it in 8 minutes. So even that construct of time is immaterial, isn't it?
Right. So you're saying that that flow is controlled by each individual human?
Frequency. No, it's not by each individual. It's frequency. You don't care how fast your blood flows. It just does.
Okay, but one, the blood seems to be flow. One human is filling up one bag and the other person's
yep.
filled up eight. So
yep.
describe the dynamic that has one person filling up one and one filling up eight side by side. There's something that differentiates. And
well, it certainly isn't time.
If it's not time, then is it...
frequency.
Okay.
The way Marshall used the word space, is that more accurate to the meaning of frequency rather than time?
Well, the application of a spaced placement.
Yeah.
A spaced, not space, a spaced
yeah.
placement is what you, that's how you arrived at your Android meme.
Right, and so that's space placement. Was Joyce
space.
Pointing that out to Lewis, or was Lewis
space.
Pointing out to Joyce, or was McLuhan pointing out to both of them?
Yes, yes, no, yes.
Right.
Very good.
So the spaced placement is more useful as a substitute for frequency than bringing any element of time in.
Well, it can be profound, okay? But do not get stuck there, because if you get
right.
stuck there, then you're going to obsolesce it before you ever retrieve it. That's the point. That's the issue. It's all right. It's certainly all right. But do not get stuck there. It will not serve you. Otherwise, it's better to forget it now than to get all tangled up about it and then have to spend 100 years to undo it.
Is this Marshall speaking or Ion?
Yes, Marshall.
Marshall, what do you think of that, Scott? That's something Marshall might... Do you think he was an advocate of not getting stuck there? I think it's what he meant, Scott, when he said break the model.
Yeah.
We couldn't even convince ourselves of anything. Why in the world would you think we'd try to convince you?
Right. That's what I'm going to try to say.
Yeah. Let me repeat what I was about to say. That's what Marshall once wrote.
I want to talk here a little bit about the relationship between time and space in terms of acceleration and deceleration. If
there is
you
not,
are,
that's velocity.
Yeah, velocity. If you are traveling at 40 miles per hour and you put on the brakes of your car...
You don't travel 40 miles per hour. There's no hour.
No, your car does. I know.
No, your car's not either. That does not apply. There's not 40
okay,
miles per
explain.
Hour. There's no hour. There's no time. Here's the proof. Okay.
Right. Okay.
You go.
I get
you
it.
Go. Okay. I'm going 100 miles. Okay. And I'm going to go 100 miles per hour. So it should take me exactly 1 hour to drive 100 miles.
Right.
Okay. Now synchronize your little clock. Synchronize the clock 100 miles away. Synchronize the clock in the car that's going to keep up with it at all this time. And you got to synchronize them. Get them exact. Get them exact. Get them exact. I'm talking to the atomic clock level. And you tear out. When you get there, what you'll find is the clock that's 100 miles away will be off. The clock inside the car will be off, and the clock that you have on you to gauge your arrival will none of them will sync up.
Yeah.
If y'all are so hot on this time business, how the hell is it that you can't even get a year to work out to the same number of minutes a year?
Yeah, my hobby horse here isn't really time. What I'm trying to understand is how we understand and then how we behave relative to it, the instantaneous nature of Internet communications, the so-called instantaneous nature of it. And
we move ahead of it. We can send you the email before you received it.
Yeah.
Right.
Before
yeah,
we
so
compose it. Before
so
we compose it. Before
certainly.
We compose it, you can send it.
Certainly.
That Ion has done that, and you're saying, Marshall, you can do that.
No, this is us.
Oh, back to this is Ion. Okay. So, Scott, these are good questions you got going here. Carry on.
Okay. Well, all that I wanted to point out here is that today I came across a really interesting article by a head strength and conditioning coach, an athletic coach at American University. And it's a brand new article.
Mm-hmm.
It's on deceleration mechanics, a lost art. And Riddle states, I am writing this article because my experience of late has shown that the ability of my athletes to decelerate their body weight, then use that potential energy and translate it back into kinetic energy, accelerating out of a jump or turn, has been lost.
Yes.
Then, as a result, there are all sorts of physical problems.
Okay. Now, here's where it was lost. It was lost when you started stroking time.
So, for a long time, our cultural bent has been moving to this position where we no longer know how to stop appropriately.
Correct. Just like no one could run a 4-minute mile until someone did, now it's the
right.
standard.
Okay. Okay.
You see?
All right. What I was thinking of is
but you can't. Now wait. Hold up just a second. Now there, you're don't run away. Stay there for a second. You're on to something. Okay. Now within a cellular strata. Okay.
Right.
You're made up of cells. And
right.
apparently this is a timed event according to you all. In this
right.
aged or aging or withering or Montague's
right.
position, you know. Well, but for some it is not. They don't rankle up, they don't wither away, they don't fall away and pass away. Okay? Their cells seemingly replicate and reproduce themselves at a level, so therefore there doesn't have to be any what you call aging. Okay? You've
okay.
seen people that were 40 years old and they look 100. You've seen people 100 years old and they
right.
look 40.
Yeah. Okay, what do you think of that supposed study, scientific study, on discovering that even when we are in maximum state of human health, that the age 114 seems to represent a limit on the planet?
No limitation. You make the limitation. The planet
okay.
doesn't limit. The planet's eternal. So are you. So,
right.
nah.
Yeah.
Because at 114, you don't have the same cells you had when you were 5.
Right,
you don't have
course.
The same lips. You don't have the same nose. You certainly don't
same
have the same fingernails.
Nothing.
You don't have the, you don't
right.
have that. You are constantly
yeah.
sloughing off and replacing. So,
okay.
not so much for us. Now, when you imply yeah. when you imply the construct of quote time, that's what you use to be this vacillation. But yet 114 is just begun.
Yeah.
So let us ask you this. If that be the case, then did cavemen know it was time to die?
I really can't answer that question.
Well, that's
but,
the point.
Yeah.
And because you can't answer that question, then time is not your dog in the fight. And we agree. But what you're trying to gain is some words to sort it out so it could actually be bantered a bit. Okay? Because it's a pretty if you've been living in a timed element all your life, it's kind of difficult to say there is no time.
Yeah.
and apply it to every single thing.
Right.
You say, I'm going to bake a cake, and you set this thing. The recipe says cook it for 25 minutes at a certain degree. Okay? Well, you cook it, and it's too done or not done enough. So the time didn't apply. That's just basically the aspect that you allow between the is and the are.
Yeah.
Is this a cookie? Yes. Are the cookies done? Yes. Then they are. Has nothing to do with time. I think that was cleaned up with your manna radar range some time ago.
I don't know what that is. That's some technology?
Microwaves.
Oh, okay.
It cooks things now from inside out rather than outside in.
Mm.
It has nothing to do with time, except that now food can be prepared or warmed or made hot lightning fast from the perspective of chopping the wood and beating the rocks together to make the spark to start the fire to start to cook your lunch.
What
it's
did
all relative.
Now, back to Marshall. Marshall, what did Corinne tell you about how you didn't understand about the meaning of the message? You said that about an hour ago.
Yes.
What did she actually tell you?
That if there was something about my work that was significant, I should have known by now.
And she wasn't getting the significance.
Well, no, maybe she did. I wasn't.
And she felt that was accurate, what she said, because of the public response?
Well, my reception to the public response.
Hmm. In other words, they were not getting it, and that helped, that confused you about what you were trying to say.
Well, and that's and ergo the vacillation, the endless vacillation.
And Corinne saw that for like 10 or 15 years and had enough with it eventually.
Of course.
So how did you respond to her irritation?
Strokes.
You started doing yoga. You started doing yoga, didn't you? Just to get along with her. You get that, Scott? That's why Barbara started doing yoga in the early 70s. Stroking Corinne.
Stroker.
What?
Comment there. I like that, but it's playful.
Yeah.
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 Well, what did you see, Scott? Does this have any resonance for you, this point that Marshall's stroking Corinne? Did you see that? Because you had a lot of close contact with them.
I wouldn't be able to make that connection. I didn't have enough time or experience
right.
with Corinne and Marshall to be able to say anything about it.
Right, you were more with Marshall at the office, not at home.
Right. I was only at home several times.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, Gwen, what were you going to say?
Well, what I was going to say is, Marshall, have you read Julian Barber's book, or did you need to, on The End of Time? Do you know Julian Barber?
No, we don't know that work.
Yeah. I think you might enjoy it.
Was that a new work?
Time. Fairly new. It was first published in 1999.
Okay.
And
so here's what I'd ask Marshall. What is it that the book must include, Marshall, to fulfill what a book that would achieve the successful communication of the end of time? What factor does the book have to have, even though you haven't read the book?
No punctuation.
Like Finnegan's Wake?
The.
Now, there's an interesting point, Scott. Finnegan's Wake already did whatever Barber's trying to do, because Barber's not showing any awareness of the medium. He's only dealing with the concept of time.
Yeah,
but that's a really good answer.
Well,
I understand that.
Construct of time.
His idea is that when you take time out of the equation in Einsteinian relativity, that you actually get a unified vision of universal processes. And I just brought it up because it would seem then that it would be a pertinent way to articulate, how we are structured by time and how we need to.
Okay, Scott.
But you're
look,
not.
Look, I'm really glad you brought it up, because that is, Marshall regarded the book Phineas Wake is a better press conference than what Einstein did with his numbers and physics. Einstein never included no punctuation in his public communication. And Marshall, you're saying that's the final factor. So if you're going to get rid of the effect of the book, which enhanced the idea of time, you got to do a book. You got to have the book be like Phineas Wake. Would you agree with that, Marshall?
Certainly, or even better than that, a good, healthy tweet.
Right? The new situation now.
Mm-hmm.
A good, healthy tweet which has no punctuation. And it's only got 140 characters.
And no vowels.
No vowels. But you're getting that is so... Marshall, I would say that is what... You couldn't, in an age of the 50s, 60s, where science was the archetypal standard, you couldn't come out and say that Finnegan's Wake was a better mathematical statement of what Einstein was trying to communicate than Einstein or anybody else, including string theory or quantum mechanics. That
we
you would
did.
Not say, but I can see that
we
in...
Did.
Yeah,
we
you did. I can. You said that in the mid-50s. The little mention of Einstein. You said mm-hmm. Joyce made way more discoveries than Einstein.
And now you can hear. Let's just give it to the test and see if you've matriculated to any type of notable aggressive
knowing
enhancement
of knowing.
Okay. OMG, is there a BFD?
Did you say is there? Oh my G, is there? Oh my God, is there a big fucking deal?
There you go. Now if the medium is the message, now communication is done very differently now.
Yeah. But
you
so
got that? Not so. It finishes the Gutenberg galaxy.
Yeah, it takes it out of the meaningless the letters, the vowels and consonants. Makes it more like a Chinese ideogram where the word is a package.
Yeah, Chad McLuhan. McLuhan always said, pointed out that science was built on letters. And the way to cancel the visualizing that science was constantly doing was to have a training of perception through a book like Phineas Wake. So he thought all physicists had no clue until they understood Phineas Wake. Is there any Phineas Wake scholar, any physicist or scientist that got to Phineas Wake? Well, Murray Gell-Mann picked the word quarks out of Phineas Wake, right? That's the story. So did he go to a subplot, a subtext? Did Murray Gell-Mann get the meaning of Phineas Wake?
No.
He didn't, but he knew it was the source of a word.
The only reason quarks are known in a physicist vernacular is because science couldn't prove that a quark was not.
Right, so that Gell-Mann picks one word to fit into whatever they were studying with their particle accelerators, and he didn't realize that the particle acceleration was already completed by Joyce's Phineas Wake.
There it is.
Isn't that interesting, Scott?
Yeah, it is.
Marshall knew that. You knew that, Marshall. That was your agenda.
Yes, we wish the same for you all.
It ended in tears, but it was a fine effort, fine agenda.
Is that because the language in Finnegan's Wake is in touch with all times and places?
Okay, Chad, so Scott's point, and then...
Okay, let's Chad's do a chart. Point. Chad
okay, yes, Chad, but say it clearly. Do it clearly, Chad.
So is that because the language in Finnegan's Wake is in touch with all different, I don't want to say times, but all different strata?
Modes of perception.
Okay.
It fits... With the Playfair cipher, it fits all the lines and spaces.
The lines and spaces of music?
Timing.
In any medium, including movies and editing. That's what you mean.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
We're getting some good stuff here, Scott. You're helping us break.
Lines and spaces, are you meaning like a visual idea of black lines on a white page to indicate some sort of time progression?
There is no time progression. It's
but you're saying there are lines and spaces.
But that's not time. That's just how you lay it out. That's
the eye versus ear. Lines is eye, spaces is ear. Something like that with tactile interplay.
And the only reason that's even necessary, it's not required at all. The only reason you've heard of playing music by ear. no problem. But you want to be able to replicate, to know what you played when you played it, that you played it. But that has nothing to do with time. What that has to do with is a relegation that you set, a relegation that you set so that someone else can have the ability or the capacity to gauge it.
That's between the is and the earnest.
That's right.
So
okay,
is
Scott.
Time, is time that okay. measurement, that system that we set up to gauge between different human beings?
No.
No?
It's a false premise. It doesn't hold soap.
It's only between you and you, Ion. It's
okay,
only
okay,
candy.
Okay.
You agree with
okay.
that? Only be between
science,
you and you?
Science should be able to offer a construct that abolishes all time easily.
When you say a construct, is that a medium or just a model?
All of it. It's
so time should be able to be obsolesced by science, the same way that Einstein obsolesced Newton.
Didn't Hoffman do that with LSD?
Well, but that no, because yes, but no. That was because see, Scott would say, "Oh, dropping a tab of acid just got you out of your mind. There was still time; you just weren't aware of it."
Right.
And we'd say, "Oh,
and you're reacting to the fact there's time by trying to escape from it. So that
exactly.
doesn't solve the issue."
That's right. What we would say is that LSD actually set a timed experience because on your, quote, trip, now you had to gauge if it was a good one or a bad one, obviously, but the trip is where you actually engaged in a lines and spaces derivative to try to play out time. And it was a fool's errand because you lost that in a head gravied trip.
So that when you use sines and cosines triangulation, is that a more accurate way to do what you were just saying LSD failed to do?
Correct.
That's something we've been working on, Scott. That's the whole project we do. But Scott, come back in with what you were going to say if you can remember it.
I wasn't going to say very much. I was just going to say that there are lots of articles on Joyce and the new physics, and particularly interpretations of the wandering rocks part of Ulysses.
Is that where there is the Muxia and the gripe section, which is I think 314 or so up to 3 something? Is the dialogue between Weinstein and Joyce, I guess. The debate between Einstein and Joyce is also got the debate between Lewis and Joyce. I'm thinking if that section deals with time and space or the end of West End, spice and West End man was Joyce's phrase. So you're saying, Scott, what there the do your with that in mind, what I said, what did you just say about...
I just said that there are lots of people that have discussed Joyce in terms of the new physics, and there was a lot of scholarly consensus that he was speaking directly to some to Einstein's notions of physics.
Right.
In terms of the shaping of his work.
Yeah, and there's even a few scholars, Thomas somebody, Don Thiel used to take him on, who thought that chaos theory Joyce addressed. So what you have is these physicists trying to fit Joyce into their concepts. They know that whatever avant-garde concepts they come up with, Joyce has got that covered, but they're still missing the visual bias in their whole enterprise, which Joyce includes in his manifesto.
Well, it actually turns into a bias.
Right. So it's interesting that the physicists... Why are they citing Joyce? Isn't Joyce not even taught in college anymore? It's like been knocked out by the feminist left or whatever, whoever took over.
No, they aren't teaching it. People are actually doing it.
Yeah, they're actually living Finnegan's Way. So it's interesting that science...
And we are LMAS.
Why would the physicists think there was any status in Joyce? I think that they... They know there's something being done there that they can't admit fully what it is. So they get the glamour of some kind of status to Joyce.
You're speaking about the essence of creation. Oh.
So they know there's the essence of creation in Joyce, and they're trying to make it technologically the essence of creation.
That's why they're still trying to figure it out.
So they say Einstein led the atomic bomb. McLuhan said that television was way more dangerous than the atomic bomb. Can we say that Finnegan's Wake led to television? Or even the internet? Or
chip body.
The chip body, which is the biggest bomb humans have made. It's wiped out everything in this past month, you know, crystallized the past month. Everything, all words are gone, including Einstein. Joyce created that possibility with his...
It's interesting that you use crystallized. Tell us what you mean.
Well, it's a term in my chart, and I see each media formation is a crystallization, a model that we get stuck with.
We didn't want your documentarianism. We wanted a definition.
I'm pointing to my chart. That's a definition. I wouldn't limit to a bunch of words, but if you require words, crystallization is...
We have to endure yours.
...is a noun, not a verb.
We have to endure yours, so if you don't know what you're thinking about...
We have to endure yours, too. We're sharing here. We're playing the same game.
If you're going to use a bunch of words that you can't define...
I did. I just say crystallization is a noun, not a verb. It's the nouning process. Crystal, solid.
Mm.
Hard, definite. Mm. And that's an illusion.
Oh,
but it is there. Did time create crystallization?
Nope.
Did the concept of time... Now, we could go into...
Time did not make nouns.
Now, we could go into what we do privately.
Now, if crystallization makes nouns, time did not make nouns. Good.
Right. Okay, so am I talking to McLuhan or Ion right now?
Ion, us.
Okay. Now, we could go into what we discuss in the rewrite and the genetics and the genome. There's that level of talk of crystallization.
Not necessary.
Right.
That's not crystalline.
What is it?
Genetics has to do with the human genome. It's not has to do with crystals or crystallization or nouns.
So crystals deal with material cause?
Your definition is nouns.
Right. Is Scott's Aristotle, Aristotelian causes, is a crystallization referring to material cause?
Aristotelian. No. We're going to clean it up. Aristocotelian.
Okay.
Better way.
That's fitting in ease.
You can find that.
Is a crystal a combination of the four causes or more the material cause?
They're not nouns.
The causes are not nouns.
Nope, you said.
Oh, they're verbs. Okay.
That's
so
right.
Crystallization. So how does that fit, Scott? If crystallization is a noun.
Well, I would just like to say that I tend to think of the DNA as a crystal. And if it is right branching, then the individual moves more to right-handedness. And if it's left branching, more to left-handedness. And there is a big debate on whether there's any difference in terms of those crystal forms because they are mere images of one another. So it would seem to
be... Depends on if you're above or below chromosome 14.
Yeah, the RNA factor is what Ion has added to understanding the genome. So ask Ion about the RNA in that pattern you just said, Scott.
No, I already understand what he meant, and I'm thinking about it.
Okay.
I'm also interested in asking about Barbara McClintock's finding of the leaping gene, which tends to, of course, change all of the structure of the DNA.
Doesn't leap.
So
when you get the human genome to where it was, you may leap a bit. That's all right.
Perfected cell.
Uh-huh.
If you get your perfected cell. So what is she seeing something do between that's going on between the RNA and chromosome 14 that she's focusing too much on the DNA and thinking it's a leaping gene?
Neither. She's not even that far.
Oh, okay. What is she trying to express with the concept of leaping gene, Scott? What's the point of it?
Well, the leaping seems to be involved with environmental structures and speciation. She was looking at it in terms of maize corn. And
Like the missing link, Darwin's missing link. This is her attempt to explain evolution?
You know, yeah, that's kind of a, yeah, I wouldn't popularize it in that way.
Yeah.
You know, it tends to reshuffle that kind of process. I'm really interested in continually looking at developments in epigenetics and how the genes are being affected by the non-environmental or anti-environmental forms of telecommunications and electronic media.
Ah, ion. Go into that. You've done stuff on that.
Fractal, that's easy.
The fractal. Yeah, I forgot to bring that up in our rewrite last night. The fractal is part of the Asher ring, right? The fractal, the antenna, not the geometric form fractal. You're talking about an antenna form ion. How would you describe it when you say it's emitting?
He asked a question of how it applies, and we said the fractal. That's it.
Right, but you're not referring to the geometric form that everybody knows fractal. You're talking about that antenna device.
Is the fractal universal as far as we know?
Do you mean the geometric imagery? Now, Scott,
universal,
you mean it?
Universal in our universe as we know our universe, no.
Hey, Scott, you mean the fractal image that we all know about. That's what you're referring to when you say fractal, right?
Well, that morphogenetic structure, the general notion of fractals, Mandelbrot series and that kind of thing.
Yeah, this is where Croker's interesting. The anamorphosis, Trump Leo,
that's
is more appropriate.
Anthropomorphic, that's where we were going, Bubby.
With the Trump Leo is more appropriate to be imaging a process than the fractal.
So far.
How can we avoid being anthropomorphic, though? I mean, I realize that we've been decentered and marginalized all anthropomorphism, and that in many ways is a very good thing. But, you know, that's something that I fight with all of the time. How do we resist, you know, the cosmological atom? That analogy that
don't resist it, embrace it. And when you embrace it and give it intention, it'll become clear as a day.
Okay.
When it does, then you won't have to battle it. You'll be able to. You won't have to battle it. You'll be able to control it.
Yeah. So you move into wave, and you move into or flowing patterns that they would be fractal, I guess, and would.
No, anamorphic. Trump Leo.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I did get confused there. Okay, I'll think on that.
You're all right, we get it, because the confusion is the essence of your knowing. That's contrast that you play with to validate your platitudes and vicissitudes. So we like that, all right? Ain't nobody
hurt. You seem to have said, Ion, that the more intense you get into your knowing, the confusion factor is in your awareness, too.
No, we said that the contrast would still be there. It would just be, it would be obfuscated.
Yeah, it'd be 51-49%. 51 knowing, 49% confusion. 51%? 51% knowing.
That's your words.
Yeah. Yep, my words.
Chad.
Yeah.
Come on.
When we were talking about crystallization, were you implying that crystallization is created by pressure?
Not necessarily, but it certainly can.
Okay. Were you leading to a process that drives crystallization?
No, not so much.
Okay.
Isn't crystallization something being isolated from other substances, and so it moves into its own elemental form, which
less than except for corundum.
the stone, corundum.
What, corundum's not not a process of isolation?
No, because it has impurities, inclusions, other things mixed together to make different things.
Yeah.
And what would be the point of the corundum compared to other forms of crystal? Does it have more...
SiO2.
Okay.
Silicon dioxide.
So corundum has more of a staying power than other crystals?
No. You got to look at the base of the silicon dioxide, because there's other things that also... Corundum was just one part, because that would hit sapphire and emerald and, you know, sardonyx and different things that would apply. Rubies, it would apply to those aspects. And they're all the same. They're all silicon dioxide. And yet
they're also silicon dioxide. You're saying that the idea of a crystal is an isolated thing is defeated by the fact of conundrum, which is a mixture.
We say it's ridiculous. We don't say that. We say that's ridiculous.
So how would you relate crystallization and our imagery of it with the flowing point Scott makes? Are we crystals in
nouns.
The flow?
They're nouns. You already cleared that up.
So the flowing with a crystalline, is that possible? If I can say it is possible, right? So it is. Into our awareness?
It is in your awareness.
See, when you asked Scott about the ego, remember that an hour or two ago, Scott, when I mentioned something about the ego?
The Eckhart Tolle syndrome.
Right. Do you include that in the flowing, Scott?
I would think it would really get in the way of any flowing action.
The ego does best is get in your way. Very good.
Yeah.
And ions for that. Ions for your ego. Ions differ from Tolle. He's not in the New Age genre that tries to get rid of your ego. Ion wants you to develop your ego if you are thinking of it as creating your power to eat your soul.
Tolle is trying you to get out of your ego.
Yeah. And you say
that's your trouble.
That'll lead to major tears.
Well, we just make it easy and say there's not one, and then you don't have to overcome anything.
Right, but that does not... So your creative power is not with the image of ego, but some people think that someone like Hitler, who takes his power, has a huge ego.
He did take his power, he just didn't keep it.
Right, he mixed it up with authority. So is ego bringing in authority issues? You know, as a weak social identity formation... Sometimes,
it's a pretty hard, pretty rough road to hoe there.
How would you describe the crystalline hardness of a knower, an ascended knower, that does not have an ego? What does it have?
Impenetrability.
Okay. And that's like a conundrum or diamond? Whatever's a hard stone?
Mohs doesn't have a hardness scale that will equate to that position.
What's Mohs? He said Mohs.
Chad, tell him what the Mohs scale is, a hardness.
Oh, Mohs scale, okay. That does not apply to this, impenetrability.
There's not one. It's not high enough. 10 is high as it goes, and this would be a million.
Right. So I would address McLuhan when he said he has a chapter in Take Today, when an immovable force, an immovable object meets an irresistible force. Marshall, are you trying to get at what we're just describing here with impenetrability?
No, that's a working definition of the nebulous, ridiculous position of magnetism.
Oh, okay. As opposed to frequency modulation.
Very good. He doesn't know anything, but he can regurgitate very well.
Right, but at the end of the day, Ion, you're telling us don't bother trying to figure out whether you want to be frequency or amplitude modulation. Get over those concepts and get out of the mind and into this more of this position of paint, starting the painting.
With your words. What you say is the power of everything. And McLuhan begins his PhD with the talking about the power of speech. Quoting Socrates. Marshall, Scott, Ion points out that most of reality is basically what you say. So if you say it is already, Now, Marshall talks about the argument in Socrates, in Plato, about the word. Were you thinking of this more secret doctrine that Ion's presenting, Marshall, in your PhD
reality
in the 30s?
Reality is the part you can't see.
Well, were you aware of that when you did your PhD in the 30s?
Well, you read it, didn't you?
Yeah, I'm just checking.
Well, and?
I don't think the reality is the part you can't see. That was not spelled out in your PhD.
Spelled out, it was the point.
Yeah, but it was not stated.
Well,
those words were not
stated. It wouldn't be real, and yet you read it as reality.
But you did end your PhD. The last sentence is about James Joyce retrieving the second sophistic, and you nod to James Joyce. That's a way of pointing out the disservice of the Gutenberg galaxy?
The obsolescing of it.
Yeah. So you intuited when you spoke to...
We didn't intuit. We knew. We knew it. We didn't intuit it. We knew it.
Yeah, when I communicated with you or around you with the Evergreens, you basically figured out Finnegan's Wake, a good beginning point in 37. So you're doing your PhD in 39, 40, 41, so you had a pretty good grasp of Finnegan's Wake, you felt, at that point.
Well, so far so good, yeah.
So think of that, Scott. He was trying to explain Finnegan's Wake in his PhD thesis because, you know, book two, chapter two is all about the trivium and quadrivium. It's called the Children's Classroom Hour. You could look at Marshall working out the battle between the grammarians, dialecticians, and rhetoricians in his PhD.
Well, and Eliot.
And Eliot. All that is in Finnegan's Wake. So your PhD, under the guise of talking about Thomas Nash, was really about Finnegan's Wake. Would you agree, Marshall?
Certainly.
What do you think of that, Scott? That's how early he perceived.
Well, I'm sorry, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
You know, well, I want to ask something else of both Ion and M. McLuhan in terms of crystallization, in terms of flow, anthropomorphic and otherwise, about the relationship of Merkaba to it. And to,
okay,
you know,
we're first. We're first. We'll take that on. That's easy. Okay, the macabre, you have a triangled position, okay? Let's put it on the earth. You got that?
Yep.
Right.
And you have the point, one of the points pointing to heaven. You
right.
Got that? The triangle sitting on the earth, it's pointing to heaven. It would look like a pyramid.
Right. Yeah.
Got it? Okay, now, you know there's something bigger than you, more than you, some completeness of you. Otherwise, the science that you've worked out already and proven says you're already dead, and you know you're not. You had a glass of red wine, that kills you. You didn't sleep enough, or you slept too much, and you ate too much fat, and you smelled a pig once. All those things will kill you, okay? So according to science, you're already dead. You can't survive going on the auspices that they've created for you on this planet so far.
Right.
It's intolerable. You're out of here. All right.
Right.
Now you know this, and yet you still are. So the point of that triangle is pointing up. Now, this isn't new. This, you can go to the Sistine Chapel and see a representation of this too. We didn't just make this shit up. We didn't graduate from MSU. All right, made shit up university. What this is this becomes a tactile representation that you can embrace. Okay, now, you come from God. That's what you little men even know. Well, you came more from God than you know. So now you have the heavens, and you have another triangle, which is completely opposite heaven looking down to earth,
right,
as it were.
Right.
You have that same triangle, and it's constantly the distance between those two pinnacles is the connection, or what we would say conductivity, of frequency, not magnetism, that draws those pinnacles together.
Right.
Okay. So now, just like the hourglass, these are the days of our lives, like the sands in the hourglass,
right.
It comes in hourglass shape. It worked out all right for Marilyn Monroe, too, but that's a different conversation. But as you move heaven closer to earth, the eternal, the prolific, the without limitation realm, as you understand it. Now, we didn't say that's the way it was. That's how you understand it. Remember,
right.
You got the sore head. You're moving heaven closer to earth. Even in your the liturgies and canons of your church, it's when heaven came down and glory fills your soul.
Right.
That merging process, once they touch the two pinnacles, something very strategically, like the game Stratego, the battleship starts waking and quaking at this point. Then the battle is on. It's the battle royale, the merging of heaven and earth.
Right.
Okay. Now, we say they already are, but you ask for the macabre dialectic, all right? So once they touch, just like in the Sistine Chapel, where one finger's reaching up and God's little David's reaching up and God's reaching down where those fingers touch, that's the conductivity, the connection. That's that same pinnacle point
right.
that we're speaking about here. But the magic of it is once those pinnacles start to intersect, something very ingenious happens. Then what happens is you have a different type of bonding that takes place. This would be the empirical difference between ionic and covalent bonding. Once that
right.
transfer takes place or connection takes place, two different kinds of empirical bonds, chemically, physically, ever what you want to call it, is absolutely every single time without fail or exception engaged. What happens is the merging is almost instant. This is the representation of what you call, what we call, what you should be calling the ascension process or
right.
ascended man, past tense.
Right.
Now here's what happens. Once that starts kicking in, every cell in those two triangles are affected by the affect of the pinnacled representation of that cumulative culmination of an ionic bond and a covalent bond, okay? They can't get enough of each other. They're different, but they can't get enough of each other. So much so that it merges into itself, so almost that, and in the Jewish people, back when you were gods, before that all got busted up,
Star of David.
You end up with a Star of David, number one, which is another clue. The same way they put that the Savior Jesus, the last Jesus, on the cross, because that's the chromosome 14 that has the only chromosome that you can adjust or has rings and arms that can allow this magical
right.
thing to transpire and take place. So you have all these little hidden clues in plain sight. Okay, but you can't know them as reality because you see them. Now, once that merges and that merging comes place, what you end up with is just like in that little book they got hidden and tucked away, that little codex that they got laid out there in Vatican City. Now you end up with this man, this what you would call perfect man.
Right.
Kind of like Chad, mostly. Well, we may have to beef him up just a little bit, but he'll do pretty good. But you mean the
Da Vinci image of man? The arms stretched out, the Marshall head on the cover of Unstained Media? Yeah, okay, that image,
Okay.
That's the limitation of the anthropomorphic there.
Well, that's right, but still, that we're trying to give him some words that work with the macabre, Bob, so come on.
Okay.
Once that merges, then inside this macabre, is the, quote, perfect man, the ascended man, past tense.
Okay.
And it's merged with heaven, and it's merged with earth. So it's not spiritual. It's not physical.
Right.
It's, by your definition, God.
Well, when you first see your higher self, you see...
As opposed to your lower self?
Well, you know.
Well, we do know. That's why we said it.
Okay, yeah, okay.
There ain't no higher self, baby. There may be a self that you think is higher than you, but it isn't. There may be something better than you that you haven't found yet, but there isn't. That's the point.
Okay.
Now, whether or not you reconcile that or not, if you want to call it that way, we'll give you a pass. We'll let you get by with that. You know, so you see what I'm saying? As long as you'll acknowledge it, that's fine. We'll let you go with this higher, lower, left, right, left, up, down, whatever. That's okay. Because you're just using it as a way to describe what you're speaking, and we'll give you that.
Right.
But there ain't no higher than you already. Good.
Right.
So this being inside the Merkaba, is that like a, does that create a force field around the ascended one?
Heart of the matter is a matter of the heart. Love is a force field. Yes, if you want to call it that.
Okay, but what's the force field have to do with the heart? Force
field
is on
the matter.
Outside.
It's the heart of the matter.
Okay, the person's inside the Merkaba, and there's a force field created by this cage of the Merkaba. So how does the heart is in the center of the person, but the force field's on the outside of the Merkaba?
No, they merged. It's like the lotus flower that would open the temple.
Like a torus?
It's like the lotus flower that would open the temple.
Okay, so it's not like the image of the torus, the toroid?
No.
Okay.
No.
Where the outside...
You got what we're saying. You got what we're saying.
So is this a crystallization that moves in terms of flow? Can I use those kinds of terms?
Well, okay, if you're going to sing the doxology, okay. Praise God from whom all blessings flow. If you're going to say it that way, we don't
doxology.
Well, then we don't like flow. Good. We agree.
Okay.
See? Do you see how we kind of twirled that a bit? If we'd have let you loose with it, you'd have got. And when we brought it back to a context that you could embrace, then you didn't like flow either. You see?
Yeah.
But now, if we'd have said the same sentence, you mean like a grand river always flows? Well, it does until you dam it up.
Yeah, I'm thinking of flow in terms of wave, I'm thinking of when you move into hyper, you move into wave, and when you move into hypo, you move into particle. And
until you get to the theta wave imagery, and then neither apply.
Right.
So you're gonna start with a false premise. It's not gonna get you anywhere. So
it's neither particle nor wave.
That's right. Well, actually. Right. If you poked at Bob, Bob's probably better at this even than non-physical. But Bob's got a real good shot. Well, he didn't have a clue. Bob could regurgitate some words that we've said that might even be real good to help with this, develop this now thoroughly for you. He can do that. You got to get him in a notion, and he's got to be not in a mood, and he'll do it. But the point is, it's actually both simultaneously. Now,
right.
Get this, both
of course.
Simultaneously. That's why we talked about it as an ionic bond and a covalent bond.
Yeah.
And see, it's
that's
rare
where,
that they would
that's
happen.
Where I feel I've really been taught because I never saw the relationship between the ionic and the covalent. So that's thank you.
That's because they teach them as two independent things that can't be at the same time, same place, same bat time, same bat station. That's the point.
We're talking about the Merkaba when we say they are the same simultaneously, or did you move on to another image, Scott?
I'm still playing. I'm trying to. It's the wrong word to use. Visualize. I'm trying to feel that field.
But I just faded out about a minute ago, and Ion said they're both the same simultaneously, or something.
Right.
What were you referring to, Ion? The Merkaba? Image or something
ionic
else.
And covalent bond.
No, before that. Unless you it was just before that. You used that as an example, but is it relevant to say the two triangles are same simultaneously?
Yes, it is relevant because that's what we were referring to in how they're bonded. And the reason they're the same simultaneously is because of ionic and covalent bonding. Good.
Yeah, now this came up in a private session earlier today. Ionic bonding is defined as communication between species, whereas covalent bonding is between electrons. If they're the same, what is difference if you acknowledge species versus electrons? What's the point there? Ionic is different from covalent on some aspect, and then the same. Ask Scott,
they're taught as completely opposite. And we say they're both occurring simultaneously. So we don't say they're different. So the
definition in the dictionary about them, ionic being between species, is not appropriate. That's not the correct definition.
Yes, it is. We're saying the spiritual God that's from heaven looking down is equitable with the species of little man running around trying to figure out who God is.
Right, and that's within ionic bonding. When you talk about sharing electrons with covalent bonding, what's the dialectic there, or what would you say is different from ionic bonding?
Look it up.
Well, why would one? Well, what, Scott? Why did they say species in ionic and electrons sharing in covalent? Do you remember that, Scott?
He doesn't. He doesn't know. He's got to look it up so he can get clear on exactly where you're trying to go. You're ahead of it, Bob. Scott, he's trying to drag it out of you, baby. He's trying to drag it out of you.
I have an inkling about what that is about, and so I can see. I feel I understand a bit of what Ion is saying.
Well, the the bonding is between the spiritual and the physical. It's chemistry and book knowledge that gets into these distinctions of ionic and covalent. Ion's saying forget those distinctions and look at what the original symbol meant.
Right. My approach to this is through the Kabbalah and through the Tree of Life and the notion of moving into Da'at. The notion of being experienced and in terms of some of the understandings which we've been discussing tonight.
Right. Now, Ion's done a lot on the Kabbalah. What factors is Scott not considering? Are there factors Scott is not considering in his studies of Kabbalah that you would point out, Ion?
He'll figure it out.
Oh, okay.
Well, we can't go busting his chops. We like Scott. He'll figure it out. He'll obsolescence.
Well, maybe if you ask Scott.
I act a lot of times as a personal coach and as a guide and to a certain degree teach the fundamentals of the Kabbalah. And so
that's the problem with it. It's not very fun.
Yeah.
That's the problem with it.
I know that. So you end up being original. for want of another, you move into...
So you're going to take Marshall McLuhan's position and break the mold? Well, you're the mold. You're the mold that must be broken.
Marshall McLuhan's position, but I like him.
We don't mind it. You're broken. That's the problem. At the end of the Kabbalah, you're broken. That's the point.
And that's the abyss.
Right, and that's the abyss that writing begins, and the eye bias, which includes the Ark of the Covenant, right, Ion? The Kabbalah is a system that works within the eye bias. You might try to overcome it, but because it's trying to overcome it, it thinks it's real.
It's acknowledging that it is.
Yeah, yeah. That's the disservice. It's acknowledging an issue, and then it tries to overcome it. And so,
I mean, the same problem occurs with the Buddhist. A good Buddhist says that in order to achieve enlightenment, then you must quench desire. And we go, well, wait a damn minute. What are you talking about? To quench a desire is a desire. So that doesn't work.
If I act a little bit egotistical here and selfish, what I'm trying to do is... I occasionally have, if you adopt the notion that there are seven different chakras in the body and seven chakras above
there
the
are,
head.
There are.
Yeah.
You're right.
Right. And so what I'm trying to do is I get the Merkaba, but I would like to be able to instruct those three or four people that I find organizing or working themselves from some of the higher chakra positions. and that's where I'm lacking the correct knowledge or feeling or awareness.
Oh, that's easy. You can't open the third eye chakra until you open the hara. Until you open the hara, you don't have to worry about chakras. You won't move chi anyway.
Okay, well, yeah, then I can say, not with a lot of confidence, but the little confidence, that I am able to do that and or act as if I can do that, and then help myself and my clients.
Because that's the only way you ever accomplish anything anyway.
That's right.
If you pretend, that's making you're intending in advance.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Ta-da.
Okay, let's talk about what somebody else wants to.
Well, I wanted to ask you, Scott, what is the hara? How do you define the hara? What is that?
My idea of it is when you move into the heart chakra and you synthesize or unify or bring together all of the different energies related to the heart chakra. I don't know. What do you think of that?
No, it's the reproductive organs, your belly, the burning in the bottom of your belly.
Yeah, but I'm saying that you use that also in terms of your heart chakra.
Your heart chakra is confined in the pericardium. It's protected. You can't reach it. You can't pierce it without forfeiting your chi.
Yeah.
So all you're trying to do is see where your energy is, and that's in your third eye chakra. And the only way to open that eye is through the hara. And after that, everything else is perfunctory.
Okay. Well, what I think of it as the reproductive organs are your reality checks, and use your reproductive organs more in terms when you're intentionally making a human life, but more often when you're trying to come to terms with brass tacks in reality.
When you figure out what orgasms are, you'll nullify all those other positions.
Yeah, but I think of orgasms as moving, being able to move your base chakra
And if not through your hara, you're in trouble.
Yeah, I can kind of see that, but I can feel like you can extend the hara down to it and still be protected.
Try it out. You'll see.
Yeah.
See, that's good. And when you try it out, and then you know, then you can come back and you say, Ion, you bastard non-physical, I have worked this out, and I know this. And we go, tell us more, tell us more, tell us more. And then if you can convince us, it's like Marshall McLuhan. If you can convince Marshall, we're a piece of cake.
Yeah, and that brings in, I'd like to address Marshall. You said one time in a Monday night seminar that, this is what I heard, you said sex is the most important thing. Just said sex is the most important thing. Now, is that you, Marshall, talking about the hara issues that Ion's talking about?
Indeed, it's the essence or the culmination of the mass.
Ah, what do you think of that, Scott? Culmination of the mass. Has that been said before?
No, but that's, I really have to think of that. I would think of that as coming to be, or in terms of aletheia or truth or something
R.
like that.
Ain't no truth. There's R. Truth's subjective.
Yeah, I agree with that.
It's an R-ness. It's R.
Okay.
Someone told me, either Mary told me this story, Mary McLuhan or somebody, that one day Quinn was showing a priest through their home, and they came to the bedroom, and they looked at the bed, and there was something with the bed. There was a heavy curve in the mattress or something, and she says, you get that curve when you're living with Marshall. In other words, she was pointing out Marshall's sexual energy. Is that something that we're saying that Marshall knew about the hara? Is that what Corinne's saying this to a priest?
Certainly.
Did that happen, Marshall?
Certainly. It's an oxymoron to be a good Catholic, but if you're a good Catholic, what else is to talk to the priest about?
Sex. That's what you talk to a priest about.
certainly.
Had you ever heard of that story, Scott?
Oh, yeah, I have, and others as well, but this line of questioning reminds me of that Dick Cavett interview of Gore Vidal.
Yeah.
And Gore Vidal, have I mentioned that before? Have you heard?
I don't think so. Go ahead.
Anyway, Gore Vidal, of course, is a celebrated bisexual. And so Dick asked Gore Vidal if he his first sexual relationship had been with a man or a woman. And Gore Vidal said very quickly, I was too polite to ask.
Very good.
Yeah, so I, you know, like McLuhan and Corrine are welcome to their own private encounter, as far as I'm concerned. I think that McLuhan was very capable of getting across his appetite in a really amusing way. I remember once, I don't know if I should tell this, but he told sometimes.
Nobody's listening, Scott. Nobody's listening.
Yeah. Scott Tatler. Instead of Scott Taylor, he called him Scott Tatler.
Okay.
It was during one of those Monday night sessions, and he motioned me over, and he pointed out one of the ladies that were in attendance, and he says, now that's a putty cat.
A putty cat?
Yeah.
You made me think. We're talking. Oh yeah, Corrine. Did you listen to last week's? Enough of the last week to hear Corrine was saying that she really put it to Marshall about something. I mean, you remember that part? Corrine explained the mass to him. Did you hear that part, Scott?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. My observation of McLuhan's relationship to the Mass was a little bit different than Corrine, but Corrine greatly expanded, McLuhan using the Mass as a ground to as great a degree as he did.
You mean in person, to you? You're not talking about what Ion said or Corrine.
That's right. So I think that, I don't know if this is true, but I think that McLuhan used the Mass somewhat like a Merkaba and as a method of being able to wrestle or talk or dialogue with Godhead energies.
Yeah, he says in his Joyce essay in 53 that you have to understand the Kabbalah and its signatures to get around in the wake. So he was aware of the Kabbalah. So Marshall, is Scott accurate in saying, what did you say, Scott, about the, I don't know how you said it.
Yeah, I'm trying to be clever.
Yeah, address Marshall what you said and see if he agrees with that or that's what he was doing. Just can't remember what
Marshall,
exactly.
Marshall, you use the Mass as your medium and as your message, and to a certain degree we can see an analogy to the...
No. The medium was the message, so the message...
Right.
Became the medium, it became the capitulation or the vacillation to apply human spirituality in an otherwise spiritless realm. It was all the gods you were going to get, you had to apply it. And that's the whole point of engaging in the sacrament was the point of connection that allowed you to validate a place of spirituality.
Right. But wouldn't you think of the Merkaba as a connecting point? As an
originating certainly. Certainly.
Point.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
But in that world, you said the word macabre, they put you over in the hoodoo section at the store, didn't they?
Yeah. Yeah, the woo-woo section of the store. So, Marshall, you consciously kept the occult references out.
Absolutely.
But you did refer to Freemasonry with the 33 chapters of Understanding Media.
Oh, more that. Than that, but yeah, at least that.
Yeah. So we came with it. We end up here with a definition, temporary ending. We got a definition there, right, Scott, of medium and message right there?
Yeah.
So
really,
I think we should.
I really like it.
Yeah, I think I'd like to end at that this point. Unless Chad has something he
Just one more thing on the Mass. Marshall, was the importance of the Mass, the crux of it, that there was some kind of a beyond sensory contact that's made?
No, it wasn't real. But it was, because you couldn't see it. So because you couldn't see it, it was real. It was made manifest because it included acts and participations that were outside of what humans knew as a potential.
Yeah, so it was a full medium. It included the services and disservices in it.
And so much so that it had to be laid out from the canonicaled priest, so you couldn't even have a direct position from it. You couldn't even have a direct connection to it. It had to go through yet someone else's interpretation regarding it. So it was perfect.
Yeah, it was a reaction to the effect of the Ark of the Covenant, but still within the world of reaction, so incomplete. But that's the, maybe the Old Testament is the Ark of the Covenant numbing, and the New Testament is the Mass numbing. You like that? The Mass was a response to the disservice of the Ark of the Covenant effect.
So it would be the numbing in Mass.
Yeah.
Good.
E-N-M-A-S-S-E, on Mass? You're punning on that, or in the
yes.
numbing in It includes the awareness of the numbing that the Ark of the Covenant unknowingly created.
And it numbed all of them in Mass.
Yeah. In Mass. E-N-M-A-S-S-E?
Yes.
Okay, great. Great ending. Thanks, Chad. So you guys have been incredible. This has been an awesome session. And we'll have more, I assume. And you're welcome to come back. All of you, including Marshall.
Yeah, good night to everybody. Hale and hearty. Stay
well,
that way.
Wait a minute, Scott. What's going to happen is that Ian's going to go away. JW will come in. You might want to just have a little interaction with JW before you leave. So thank you very much, Ian and Marshall. And
thank
Prince.
You.
You are most, most welcome. Enjoy.
Oh, okay, so JW's not coming in. Because Ian came in on its own rather than me, bringing JW in and then evoking Ion, whatever you call it, we don't have to have Ion go away and JW come back. You see the difference, Scott? Because Ion came in on his own, he actually came in when I phoned in just before you and Chad called in, and there was Ion. So that's why Ion leaves now and there's no JW. Normally there's a JW when you do a private session, when Ion leaves. So there we are. Okay, so what's your time there, Scott? 11?
It's 10:37.
Oh, that's good.
And I'm wide awake. And some of the things I've maybe been trying to do, I have been failing because there are universal prescriptions or prohibitions regarding it. So for my own good. Anyway,
That was very beneficial. Your interaction with Ion was beneficial, is what you're saying.
That's right.
Very good. So we'll meet again.
You bet.
All right.
You're an awesome guy, and I enjoy all your friends.
Okay, so you're on my line, so you can hang up. I'm going to stop the recording, and then I'll talk to Chad.
Okay. Night-night, Chad.
Good night, Scott. It was nice to meet you. You brought up a lot of great stuff. Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah, you added some really interesting discussion points. Thank you so much. You got to come back.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye. Hey, just a minute, Chad.